the Rockies, and you're listening to AM 1500 KSTP. From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening, good morning, as the case may be, across this great land stretching from the Tahitian and Hawaiian island chains in the west, where we can conjure up images of, native girls, hammocks, great big palm fronds, just sort of drinks with little umbrellas, you know, out into the east and the Caribbean, where similar visions are absolutely possible, South America, where they're possible, and north, where you better be dressed warmly all the way to the pole, and worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM, top of the morning for most of you. I'm Art Bell, and it's great to be here, and tonight we are going to continue our exploration of, in a radio kind of way, of the pyramids. And we're going to have Boris Said back. He was a big hit last time on the program. Mr. Pyramid, Boris Said, I guess. And with him tonight is Tom Danley. Now, who's Tom Danley? Well, Tom is the engineer, a one-time consultant to NASA, and is a sonic engineer. And guess what he did? He's the one who did all the sonic tests in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid in Egypt, a place I just happened to get to go recently, have fond and recent memories of. In fact, it will be etched into my life forever. So, obviously, we are going to talk to, about the pyramids. Now, we're going to also talk about the secret chamber, believed to be located beneath the left paw of the Sphinx, and what, indeed, may be awaiting there. But first this, I want to tell you a really, truly amazing story. Last year, in my state, he says proudly, of Nevada, Wells Fargo Bank discovered all of these coins, these $20 gold pieces. What a discovery. That must have been lying maybe in a dark corner of the vault, or I wonder where they found them. That, of course, is something you will find out in the history of these coins, which they will send you free of charge. So get a paper, pencil. These coins, and there are many, many, many of them, are absolutely astounding, not just because of the quantity, they found many, but because of the quality. As I've told you, a fine coating of gold dust, which is typical normally of coins fresh from the mint, was found on the coins. So what they initially did is to take photographs of the coins, because these coins were minted, all of them, in 1908, about 90 years ago. But they're so fresh, so new, that there's still this fine coating of gold dust. Now, what they will do is send you free information on the history of these coins and photographs of these coins, so you might see for yourself, free of charge. Take a look. 1-800-359-4255 is the number. 1-800-359-4255. That's right. All right. Let us see if we can connect with the parties involved. I suspect on this line, Boris Said.
I'm here. Good evening, Art.
Good evening, Boris. Great to have you back on the program.
Well, it's nice to be back.
All right. Let us see if the other half of this connects. Tom Danley, hello there.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi, Tom. Where are you, Tom?
Near Chicago.
Near Chicago. And Boris is up in Washington on some kind of island or something, right,
yes.
Boris?
Friday Harbor in the beautiful San Juan Islands.
Okay. All right, so both of us are here. I think that it would be appropriate
Considering that we've got a lot of new affiliates, we've been growing very quickly. Boris, for you to give us a little bit of background on yourself, and then for Tom to do the same thing so we understand who we're talking to here.
Okay, I can tell you briefly that for the last 8 years, I've been involved with making documentary films in Egypt. I started out with John Anthony West and Robert Schock, and we created a documentary special for NBC, which was hosted by Charlton Heston, which gave pretty conclusive evidence that the Sphinx was really 12,000 years old. And part of that evidence had to do with the way some of the stones were lifted in the temples, and that's where I met Tom. Tom was doing sonic levitation experiments, I believe in connection with work they were doing for NASA at the time, and we featured Tom on that program. A lot of people saw that program, over 200 million people so far. It's won an Emmy, and it was quite successful. That film, in doing some of the underground testing to try and validate Dr. Schock's opinion that the Sphinx had been exposed to the weather for several thousand years longer than anybody thought, in doing the seismic backup for the geology, we turned up a 30 by 40 foot chamber under the paws of the Great Sphinx, which coincidentally was right where Edgar Cayce said it would be.
Mm-hmm.
We then spent a couple of years trying to get permission to drill directly into that room without much success.
All right, let me stop you there, Boris,
okay,
because you're getting into the story itself.
Okay.
The guy who operated the equipment that found the chamber was Dubecki, wasn't
it? Dr. Tom Dubecki.
Dr. Tom Dubecki. But Tom Danley, who's on the line with us, is... Tom, tell us about yourself.
Okay, hi. I'm an inventor and engineer and primarily work in the acoustics and electronic area. And most of my life I've worked in the acoustic field, and when I met Boris, that's what I was doing at Intersonics. Intersonics was a NASA contractor. We built flight hardware for the shuttle and sounding rockets. And Boris's crew came out to the factory to film levitation, and that's where I met him.
I saw in the videotape that Boris has, I saw your levitation of a material object with nothing but sound. How do you do that, Tom?
Well, the technique that we used requires a fairly intense sound field. You can begin to levitate, let's say, something low density like styrofoam with around 150 decibels, which is quite loud. And
of what frequency? Of any frequency or of a lower frequency?
Well, in the film that you saw, we were using a high frequency, around 22 kilohertz or 22,000 vibrations a second.
Oh, that would be very painful to the human ear, wouldn't it?
Well, if you stuck your ear directly in the sound field, yeah, it would be extremely loud. The high frequency like that, though, your ears are already not very sensitive to it, where if, say, it were an octave or two octaves lower, it would be extremely uncomfortable.
From a technical perspective, why a high frequency versus something very low, which you would think would carry more oomph with it in terms of levitation ability?
Well, the size of the object that you're trying to levitate is pretty much governs the frequency that you need to use.
Really?
The size of the samples that we were dealing with at Intersonics, they were, well, it's about the size of a pea, let's say. That's around the quarter wavelength size for a 20 kilohertz signal.
So in other words, it's got to be roughly resonant with the object's size.
Well, there is a range. It's not a hard and fast limit, but the largest thing that you can levitate is about a quarter of a wavelength across, And the smallest thing that you can levitate would be maybe a tenth of a wavelength across. So within that range, you can levitate objects. So a low-frequency sound would allow you to levitate a very large, you know, object.
All right. The reason for the connection to the research between sonic levitation and the pyramids, from a layman's point of view here, has got to be that somebody, probably Boris and others, have speculated that the way the pyramids were built was with possibly some sort of sound or acoustic levitation.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, how the heck did they get those great big rocks up there? But your experiments, Tom, don't really demonstrate that there would be any way to convert that, do they, to something that would lift a rock that weighs how much, Boris?
2.5 tons, some of the stones weighed.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the ones down in the lower temples, in the Sphinx Temple and the Valley Temple, weigh upwards of 200 tons.
Uh-huh. So in the range of 20 to 200 tons, Tom, what can you levitate?
Well, I can't levitate anything. No, it's in theory you could still do it. It would be difficult to produce that much sound, and for low frequencies would be rather dangerous sound levels for the people that were involved, you know, being around. It's possible, though, that sound was used for other things, too.
Oh, absolutely. But I would like to just stop you and ask you, in your professional opinion, is there any way, with technology you can even imagine, that they could have used sonics to lift these incredible rocks, and particularly as high as they did?
Not that I see, no. Short of having a time machine, though, you can't really say how they did it. Like I said, though, there are other things that sound could have been used for, like to reduce the friction of moving the stones. If you have something that's vibrating, moving an object across it will have much less friction if there's vibration involved. So,
interesting.
That's another possibility.
Even when you talk to Dr. Zahi Awas, Director of Antiquities over there, and you ask him how the pyramids were built, he goes, I don't know. You know, I don't know. That's part of the mystery.
Well, if I can jump in for a second, I'd like to point something out. When we did the experiments in the first show, we interviewed a guy with a giant crane. He had some humongous great crane, the largest land-based movable crane in the world or something. And he flat said, I don't see any way you could lift these stones, even using two cranes.
Yeah.
Now, what I think Tom's experiments suggest is that in theory it could have been done. And yes, we don't know how it's done today, but 50 years ago we didn't know how to float an object the size of a pea without touching it. So the point is that if the principle works in a tiny object, why then couldn't a combination of these principles, why isn't it just logical to assume that we will ultimately figure out how to lift bigger and better objects?
Well, it's true. The principles are don't prohibit it from happening. And if they did have a way of producing the intensity and frequency that was desired, it would be possible to do.
Well, you know, Art, it leads us into where we hope to be going next year with our series of specials, and that is the investigation of the principle of vibration as expressed in sound. Dr. Jim Hertog from the Academy for Future Science suggested to me one day that in layman's terms, the pyramid was the world's biggest music box.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the test that we did with Tom there this last trip suggests that it was designed and built with materials that all contributed to enhancing certain resonant frequencies.
All right.
Which may have had a specific purpose.
The part of Tom's work with regard to the pyramids that I find most interesting is that done inside the King's Chamber.
Yeah, I agree.
Tom, I got an opportunity to go over there a couple of months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Got got, in fact, a lion sarcophagus.
Oh, excellent.
And hummed and talked and was astounded, I guess astounding is the only word I can think of,
mm-hmm.
by the, and I still have yet to put together all the right words to even describe it in words, what I felt. I haven't been able to quite do that yet. But what I got in return was a total body feeling of some sort. In other words, the resonance produced in there affected my entire body. And I'm not sure, one of these days I'm going to come up with the right words for it. Now, obviously, you have just made a very long climb. It's hot, and you're almost in an altered state already by the time you get up there. But that did not change what I felt when I got in that sarcophagus. So what did you find sonically up there?
Well, there's a couple layers to that, to the answer.
All right.
And yes, I certainly have to agree. The acoustic effect laying in there is absolutely phenomenal. What really got me interested was when Boris called and said, you know, when you're laying in there, you won't believe what it sounds like. And acoustically, yeah, okay. But no, it is very remarkable and unlike anything I've ever heard myself. What we found was a couple things. There are resonances in any room due to the dimensions of the room. And that would also be true of the sarcophagus. And what we found was that when you're, for a person that was laying in the sarcophagus,
mm-hmm.
Several of the resonances of the sarcophagus and the room happen to coincide at the same frequency. So,
all right, let me stop you. How is that possible? In other words, the sarcophagus being of the size it is, and when you lie in it, of course, you have four walls about you and an open area above you to the rest of the king's chamber.
Mm-hmm.
Now, wouldn't the frequency, resonant frequency, be dependent on the size of the enclosure?
Yes. The lowest frequency that there would be resonances would be set by the absolute dimension. However, at multiples of those... in other words, we're...
Harmonics.
Yeah, harmonics, exactly. So there, a room will have quite a series of resonances set by the dimensions of the room. And several of the higher order resonances in the chamber coincide with the fundamental resonances that are in the sarcophagus. So although the room is much larger... there are several of those resonances which overlap, and energy can be transferred from one to the other. In other words, if...
But the relationship is harmonic.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, a multiple of...
Right.
The sarcophagus would be a multiple, I would think, higher in resonance than the rest of the king's chamber?
Yes, the... If you looked at the spectrum of sound in the King's Chamber itself, it actually starts well below audibility. And that, maybe we should come back to...
Well, no, let's stay with it right now. Generally, what does an average human being hear at the low and high end?
Well, if you looked in a textbook, the answer to that question would be from about 20 vibrations per second to, if you have good ears, around 20,000 vibrations a second.
So 20 hertz to 20K.
Yeah. Now, in reality, it's the response or sensitivity of your ears doesn't just stop at either end. It just, your sensitivity declines as you approach either end. So you actually can hear sounds that are much lower than 20 hertz. We built a sonic boom simulator as one of the projects at InterSonics.
A sonic boom simulator?
Yeah, a system to produce sound on the outside of a house, which would be equivalent to the NASA space plane going over.
Ah.
And that system produced sound down to 3 vibrations per second. And once you have enough intensity, even a very low frequency like 3 hertz is audible. Your threshold of hearing is around 120 dB, so you have to produce a fair amount of sound, but you still can hear it.
Tom, when we were in the King's Chamber that night and everybody got frightened and you were getting lower and lower, how far down do you think we heard? Remember when it all seemed to start to shiver and we all ran out of the chamber?
Right, when we sat up in the hall instead.
Well, I don't know about this night, Boris.
I'm sorry?
What? You'd not told me about this.
Oh, I'm sorry. When we were testing one night, Tom got all his equipment set up, and all of us, the whole crew, everybody down. I'll tell you, as far as I was concerned, I thought we were having an earthquake. It was extraordinary. And everybody sort of looked at everybody sideways and nervously looked up at the ceiling and then fled like jackrabbits out through the tunnel and into the Grand Gallery, from which we watched the rest of the proceeding. It was an amazing experience. How low down do you think?
How many of you were there total?
What do you think, Tom? 7 or 8?
Yeah.
7 or 8 of you. All taking off like frightened chickens, huh?
Yes.
All right, you two, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. Somehow I can picture that, particularly at night. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
With Art Bell from west of the Rockies, including Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico, dial 1-800-618-8255. That's 1-800-618-8255. Now again, here's Art.
Once again, here I am, and guess what, folks? I've got 2 supremely good reasons for you to go to my website right now. Reason number 1 is to see a diagram of the secret chamber that lies below the Sphinx and where we believe the tunnel to it goes, the access to it goes. So it's just a simple little graphic with a picture of the pyramid in the background and the Sphinx and the tunnel and what is believed to be under it. Now that's in the news section of the website. But now let me give you a second grand reason to go up there, all right? We have a new product. This product, we should all bow down 3 times to the east, or maybe in this case, the west. No, the east, I suppose. And thank the German people for. As you know, here doing a network program, I don't need to tell you, or maybe I do, time is incredibly important, incredibly important. I must have a dead accurate clock or I'm doomed. Well, I have fought the battle of the clocks now for a couple of years and tried different wall clocks, you know, that kind of thing. And then, of course, there is the second horrendous issue with time, other than inaccurate clocks, and that is that if you live in one of the many unfortunate states that twice a year have to change their time, I don't know about you, but I get angry. I spend half a day changing my clocks. All right, we now have a new product. Listen to me very, very carefully. It is called the Zeit Clock. It's from Germany, and I'm no doubt not saying it properly as the Germans would say it. It is, the best way I can think to describe the clock to you is, do you remember in school when they had a clock that goes? I do because I watched it a lot. It used to be a hobby of mine, watching the clock. And that is the kind of clock that I have to have for the kind of accuracy in time that I need. Now, this new product is a full-size 12-inch wall clock. If you go to my website right now, I did not take a good photograph of it. I just took my little studio camera and pointed at my clock on the wall. So it's kind of at an angle. But I want you to go to my studio, live cam studio shot, and take a look at this clock. Now, let me tell you about this clock, in case you can't see it. This clock is accurate to within 1 second in a million years. 1 second in a million years. How can they do it? Well, they do it by radio. This clock runs on a single AA battery. This clock receives signals that you would never hear, silent radio signals that come from the National Bureau of Standards in Boulder, Colorado, where they've got an atomic clock, a cesium clock. And many times, every hour, this clock automatically sets itself with the atomic clock in Colorado. Now, is that cool or what? Now, it automatically, brace yourselves, it automatically changes from Pacific Daylight Time to Pacific Time, or, you know, whatever time zone you're in. Or if you don't change, you can set it not to change. So in other words, when the day comes to change, it knows, and it automatically changes itself. Hallelujah! Hallelujah! And when you first get it, you will notice you put it up, put the battery in. You don't set the clock. You just wait, and in a few minutes, it gets a signal, and it starts going around like crazy. The second hand's going, and it keeps going until it sets itself, and then it stays accurate to within 1 second in a million years. Guess what else? This clock has temperature and humidity dials on it as well. It is a clock I am using, and it can be the clock you use too. Guess how much? Now, I've got to tell you right up front, they're all going to sell out later today. This is an introductory product, but right now, the price is $99.95. $99.95. It is an utterly, totally automatic clock. If you want one, get one in the morning by calling Bob Crane. Good luck. I would do it early. They open the doors at 7:30 a.m. And if you want to see it, just go up to my website and click on the live studio cam. And it's a poor shot. I'll try and get a better one, as a matter of fact, to get up there shortly. But I wanted you to see this. It is so cool. One of my guests, Tom Danley, who was a consultant to NASA and is a sonic engineer, and, of course, Boris Said. Gentlemen, you're back on the air.
Hi, Art. I suppose I should ask you what time it is.
It is, well, I can tell you exactly on the West Coast, it is,
in a second.
It is 10:42 and 55 seconds, Mark.
Mark.
This clock is so cool.
Can I say something just briefly to your listeners who wrote in and ordered our tape?
Yes.
The last show.
Yes, of course.
That we were delayed about 10 days in production. We discovered a production glitch when all the tapes ready to go out. And so those of you who have not gotten your tapes, you're going to get them. Patience, and thank you. You all ought to have your tapes in the next week or so.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And by the way, you know, I just thought of something. I gave the exact time, and I said, Mark, but I have a 6-second delay. And then I have about another second delay or so by satellite. So you shouldn't have made me do that. People are going to sit out there and say, hey, man, that clock's wrong.
Sorry about that.
Anyway, let us go back now to the King's Chamber. And, Tom, you said there was a relationship harmonically between the actual sarcophagus and the King's Chamber itself. And you began to tell me about all of you running out of there. Now, was this at night?
Yes, this was, I think it was about, we usually started around 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock in the evening.
Yeah, I think it was about then. I recall, I mean, what's the difference? It's dark in there anyway, right?
Right.
I mean, we had our own lights. We had our own illumination. For the
building. It's dead dark in there.
I mean, we had full lights going.
Uh-huh. Okay, what actually began to happen?
Tom?
Well, we did, the first test we did were higher frequencies in the sarcophagus itself. We put a loudspeaker and a microphone in the sarcophagus and took those measurements. Then we switched to a speaker that produces very low frequencies called a Phoenix Cyclone. And that we put in the King's Chamber itself and repeated the same type of measurement, but now going down to below audibility and frequency wise. And as we swept through the various resonances, we found several in the low frequency region that were quite strong, and those are in the range, let's say, of a very low note on a pipe organ, if you can picture that. And exciting those resonances with that sound source produces a fair amount of sound, and in fact it was kind of kind of scary at one point, the effect that has. I mean, it certainly hits your fight or flight reflexes fairly hard.
Does it really?
Yes.
It's like an earthquake. It was extraordinary. I mean, you know, none of us were faint-hearted in that room, and I'll tell you what, it was a fight to see who got out of there first.
We decided it was better to set up in the hallway rather than.
What were you? What frequency range were you in when you hit this horrendous fight or flight thing?
The strongest resonance would be somewhere around the lowest note on a pipe organ, which is below 20 hertz. But we also found resonances that went down much lower than that. And the part of it that I think was most interesting, or curious to me anyway, was that we had made a DAT recording, which is a digital tape recording,
sure,
of everything we did. And after we got back home, had a chance to analyze the recordings in the computer, one of the things that showed up was the presence of several of these low-frequency resonances, even when we weren't producing any sound.
Oh.
Those frequencies were present in the King's Chamber all by themselves.
Now, how is that possible?
Well, I made a mathematical model of the rough structure of the pyramid, and treating it as simply as possible acoustically, and saying that the air shafts and the room itself were similar to blowing across the neck of a pop bottle, which is called a Helmholtz resonance. And what started me thinking about that was a movie clip that Boris sent me that shows the clouds and things blowing around the outside of the pyramid. So you certainly have a reasonable source of excitation with the wind, and the dimensions of everything involved are such that the frequencies that would be produced are right in the same range of what we found. In fact,
where are these openings to the outside? Because when I was in the King's Chamber, I saw no opening.
Well, there's two. There's one on the north wall and one on the south wall, aren't they, Tom?
Well, the King's Chamber passages are blocked off.
Right.
The what they call the star shafts or air shafts, and it's I think somewhat questionable whether those are star shafts or not, because if they were, you would think they would be set up so that you could sight through them, but instead they go about 10 feet straight and then angle up. If you take the model and include both of those air shafts and look at the prediction and then say, okay, well, those are closed off. Let's model the main tunnel that goes into the King's Chamber. You end up with something that's almost exactly the same. So acoustically, what you would expect with the air shafts being open is pretty similar to what you have using the access tunnel that El Mammon carved to get in there.
Mm-hmm.
Bear in mind also, Art, that when they built the pyramid, the sides were smooth. So that effect of the wind blowing, if it was in fact the air shafts, which we have to assume at one point were probably open, if the sides of the pyramid were smooth, then the effect would have been more pronounced.
Okay. Why are there air shafts in there in the first place?
What a great question. Are they air shafts, or were they not part of the pyramid of the giant great resonance chamber or music box or a scientific instrument of transformation, which is what I think it is? In other words, if the whole thing was designed, I mean, it's beyond comprehension, it's beyond any sort of mathematical possibility that it's just accidental that the sarcophagus and the room complement each other. And it's beyond the realm of possibility, I think, that if you take those star shafts that Tom was talking about, or those air shafts, and you assume that at one point they were open, otherwise why would they have built them? And of course, Gantenbrink's robotic camera found that there was a door at the end of one of them, I think, from the Queen's Chamber. If in fact those were part of this great vibrational instrument, then we're looking at the proof of an advanced society before our very eyes, which is what my premise has been from the very beginning.
I know. Tom, how likely do you think that is?
Well, initially I would be skeptical of that. However, there are some things that sort of back that up. If you looked at the field of meditation, for example, meditation was the first way people were able to control the state of their brain activity.
Right.
You learned a procedure which led to a change in brainwave state.
Right.
Then there was biofeedback that monitored your brainwaves and gave you a better access to what you were doing and would allow you to change states much quicker than learning a meditation routine. One of the things that's popular right now are the what they call light and sound machines that have headphones and glasses with lights in them.
That's right.
And the idea with that is you present your brain with a stimulus that it just can't ignore, and you're sort of taken on a meditation ride.
And so that is, in essence, what occurs inside the sarcophagus, inside the King's Chamber itself, is a sort of an altered state, is produced even by the natural, forget the Tom Danley equipment, sonics and all the rest of it, by this a subtle but very interesting frequency combination.
Yes, and the very lowest frequencies that we found are certainly in the range of your brain activity. In other words, the frequencies correspond. The lowest frequency that we saw was, around 3 vibrations per second.
Oh, my. Oh, my, that's very low. Tom, what is the Schumann resonance?
I have a frog in my throat tonight. One of those is the set by the time it takes, excuse me, a radio signal to travel around the Earth. And it's, as I recall, 6 or 7 vibrations per second.
Right, exactly. I think it's around, actually around 7.3 or 7.8, I can't recall. But somewhere right in that range. In other words, we might think of that as the actual frequency of the Earth itself. Is that reasonable?
Yeah. That's, a lot of people refer to it like that.
So it's not a surprise, then, that our basic brain waves or effect on our brain is achieved at about the same frequency. In other words, maybe it's a stretch, but we are, in a way, in tune ourselves with the Earth.
Yeah, and I believe the alpha level of brain activity is right around 7 cycles per second.
Yeah, there you go. So it's reasonable to conclude that the Earth's frequency affects us. Not so reasonable to conclude we affect it. Mm-hmm. However, I've had recent guests who have suggested the Schumann frequency is, for some reason, unaccountably rising. Have you heard that?
No. I've heard it on your program. And I've heard it suggested that perhaps the pyramids were monitoring devices by which our extraterrestrial neighbors could keep an eye on what was happening with the vibrations on Earth.
Mm-hmm. One has to wonder if the Schumann frequency were to change, whether eventually that would have an effect on the human brain itself.
Well, it's conceivable. I mean, we're tied into the environment in ways that people are still beginning to understand.
It sounds like you've got yourself quite a cold there, Tom.
Yes, actually, I have to apologize.
If I can step in and bail Tom out, there's an interesting thing that's brought out in our tape. These notes that Tom discovered, among other things, form an F-sharp chord. Now, I'm not a musician. I'm sure there are a lot of musicians listening. I know, for example, that our composer suggested when he heard the notes that it sounded a little like Jimi Hendrix's Purple Haze. But we found an extraordinary thing, and we brought this out in our film as well. When we got out to Oregon, we interviewed a Yaqui, a Native American Yaqui, maker of ceremonial flutes, a fellow named Ward Stroud. And Ward suggested that many of the Native shamans, when they made their sacred flutes, which were made to serenade Mother Earth originally,
right,
many of these flutes are tuned to the same F-sharp chord. So, in fact, many of these American flutes that are handmade from hardwood 12,000 miles away are tuned to the same frequencies as 2.5 million blocks of stone in Cairo.
Why would they do that? I mean, is it just a sound that we would recognize and immediately identify with at a level we wouldn't even consciously understand?
Well, probably. I mean, certainly the shaman knew. I mean, they that's what made them shaman. They corresponded with the earth. They made flutes originally to serenade the earth, and then they were used to serenade their ladies and so forth.
Uh-huh.
But they presumably knew what they were doing.
All right.
Somehow, mystically.
All right. Boris Said and Tom Danley are my guests, and they will be back following the news at the top of the hour. And we are discussing sonics for now. We are going to get to the secret chamber, so stay right where you are. KSTP.
Bell is talking to first-time callers at area code 702 702-727-1222. That's area code 702-727-1222. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nine.
It is.
Now again, here's Art.
Yes, yeah, I'm always jumping the gun. Tom Danley, who's a sonic engineer, once consulted to NASA in that regard. And of course, Boris Said are my guests, and we are talking inevitably about the pyramids, specifically the sonic vibrations right now, the Great Pyramid. We'll get back to that in a moment.
Told you to call.
Just a small programming note. I have booked for this Friday night, Saturday morning, Whitley Strieber. And it's been a while, and Whitley has an incredible story to tell you about what's going on in Wyoming, and I'm not going to say any more about it than that, but believe me, he's got quite a story. So Whitley Strieber, this coming Friday night and Saturday morning, whichever way you want to look at it. Now back to Tom Danley and Boris Said. All right, gentlemen, Boris, are there any questions that you think we should be asking Tom with regard to the sonics in the pyramid that we have not yet asked?
Yeah, there is. There's one question, and it's a general question, and I don't want to put you on the spot, Tom, but there have been, in my lifetime, pieces of music that we just gravitate to. Sometimes it's because of the words, like White Christmas, what have you. Sometimes, in the case of Jimi Hendrix, it's just like one song, like Purple Haze. I mean, people who weren't even fans. We're humming that sound. We're making that sound. If we're living in a vibrational world, if we're living in a world of vibration, and vibration can be most easily interpreted as music, it can be color as well. Do you think it's possible, Tom, that we could establish around the world that these sacred sites, stone sites, cathedrals, stone circles, what have you, have been built with a certain sonic logic? And I know you have a paper that speaks to that in England, but do you think that this is a wild goose chase, or do you think we're really looking for something we might be able to actually demonstrate?
No, I think there is something to it. It's only been in the last 20 or 30 years that detailed analysis of buildings has been possible through acoustic theory. However, some of the very best listening halls that have ever existed were built long before any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned the paper that showed some of the ancient structures in Ireland and England apparently had been built to help reinforce the sound of the human voice. And so I think acoustics has gone from sort of a mystical black art into a formal science. But I also believe very strongly that in ancient times there were people that were very skillful and knowledgeable of acoustics, although maybe not in the same way that we are now, that designed, you know, say some of the cathedrals and halls and stuff like that.
Tom, I've got a question for you that is off the wall and doesn't relate to what we're talking about, at least not directly. I have heard of noise cancellation.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that it would be possible to take the noise coming from an aircraft, for example, or a jet or something, and emanate a signal as well that would, for the listener on the ground, in essence, cancel the sound of the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Is that possible?
Well, to some degree it is, yeah. Basically, what you're producing is a sound that is exactly out of phase, or the inverse of the offending signal.
Right.
And when the two mix together, they cancel each other out. There are a number of companies that make equipment to do that job for, well, air ducts is one field where it's fairly popular. to cancel the noise coming through an air conditioning duct, let's say, and also on machinery. It's something that's done not in common practice, but it's certainly possible.
All right, my question would be this. Let's say that you successfully canceled the sound of a jet engine, just for the sake of the discussion. There would then be two opposite sounds, 180 degrees out of phase with each other. You would hear, the end result is, you would hear nothing. But would you still be aware of the presence of the sound? I'm not sure I'm asking this properly, but the sound would still be there. It simply would be canceled. So if it were many, many decibels, would your ears still be subject to that pressure?
No, actually.
Really?
What you're doing when you cancel the sound is you erase the pressure part of it. The difficulty, though, is that... Well, in the case of an airplane flying by, the closer to the source you can place your cancellation signal, the more effective you are at canceling the signal over the entire area.
Right.
If you had, let's say, a microphone on a pole in your backyard and a speaker system to do the job, you could cancel some of the sound locally, in other words, in your yard, as the plane flew over. But
interesting.
That would be for fairly low frequencies where the dimensions of the wavelengths are large.
All right. Now, back to the King's Chamber at Giza. Tom, what do you think the purpose of that pyramid was or is? Surely we have not found pharaohs or people buried there?
No, that's true. I don't know if I don't have my own theory, that's for sure, but what I can say after actually being there and going in a number of the places that we went to, that I went to with Boris, a couple things strike me. That for one thing, the Egyptians were very skilled at building tunnels and caves underground.
Mm-hmm.
We went in one that was over 100 feet deep and had several different levels. And the pyramid also has several underground passages that appear to come up underneath the structure itself. They're all blocked off now, but given the ease with which they were tunneling, it's very easy to imagine that there was an underground access to the inside of the pyramid. That would be one observation. The other thing is that a lot of the theories about the pyramid say that it wasn't a tomb, and certainly the fact that they never found any mummies or anything else that directly pointed to that sort of supports that. If the pyramid were constructed to be a temple or a site of a ritual, then you have a whole different scenario possible, that the sound part of the system was intentional and was designed into it.
Actually designed to produce an altered state.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Then a next obvious question, Tom, is couldn't you duplicate the acoustic properties of the pyramid, for example, on a CD or with some sort of computer-generated sound return to a sound you would make? I'm asking, in some way, would it be possible to come up with something that would duplicate the altered state produced by being there?
At least to some approximation, you could, yeah. The one of the things that's completely unique about the pyramid acoustically, though, is you have a situation where you have a structure that is about as rigid as it's possible to make.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think of hundreds of feet of stone all around you, that is a fairly solid object. And so obviously that circumstance you wouldn't run into in a normal house or even one made of bricks.
So the suggestion there would be there are properties when you're actually in the pyramid that go beyond simply the sonics produced by.
Well, the fact that it is so rigid makes it have its own set of unique acoustic properties. You could, on the other hand, produce those same frequencies with the speaker that I used to test with, the Cyclone, that's capable of producing those frequencies too. So you could set that up in a room and try and approximate the experience.
Have you done that?
No. In fact, just as the words left my mouth, it occurred to me, gosh, I should try and set that up.
Well, what you guys are doing is reading the script to our second show, because one of the things we hope to do here next year, early in the year, is do some tests down in Mexico and Central America and some of those pyramids, and then do some comparison studies. And I'm going to ask Tom to make a computer model and to see if we can approximate somehow these vibrations, and then do some tests, and hopefully with some of the people that are testing in this field, like Dr. Valerie Hunt, people like that, if we can get them interested in this idea, that's how I hope to prove that Atlantis isn't buried. I think we're going to find it. I think we've found it. It's just a question of describing it in terms we can all understand.
I can tell you one thing that Zahiawa said to me when we were standing by that square hole in the side of the Sphinx, Boris.
Yeah.
He said, not one shred of evidence, not one grain of sand, not one thing ever found here at Giza leads toward any conclusion or proof that Atlantis will be found.
Okay, tell me how come you and Tom used the same words. You both lay in the sarcophagus, and you came out and you were astonished and amazed and astounded.
Oh, I don't dispute that for 1 second, but I'm not sure how that relates to Atlantis.
Well, the point is this, that Atlantis is a word that we've used to describe sort of generically some pretty clever ancestors. And whether they were Atlanteans or Egyptians, I'm sure if we stopped calling them Atlanteans and started calling them Egyptians, we'd get a lot more support in Egypt.
I think you're probably right.
But the point is that nobody I've ever talked to who's been a tourist, who's gone around Egypt, normal, intelligent people capable of earning enough money to go to Egypt on holiday, and they go through all the tombs of the Left Bank, and they go through all the tombs on the Giza Plateau, and then they go to the pyramid. Not anybody that I've ever talked to in 10 years of working over there has ever said to me, gee, this feels like a tomb. Everybody comes out and says, the one thing we're sure it's not is a tomb.
Yeah, I agree.
Now, you know, Zahi Hawaz is a friend, and I have utmost respect for him, and I think he's an Egyptologist and an archaeologist and a very bright guy. But I don't think he's correct in this assumption. I think that he is discounting the kind of stuff that Tom DeBecky and Tom Danley are turning up, which I think speaks to a highly advanced society which created this rational, logical structure.
I couldn't agree more, but that does not have to automatically lead to Atlantis or point to the fact that it was an Atlantis society. It could have been whoever was there before the Egyptians.
Oh, exactly. I've never, Bob Schock said that in their first tape. He said that they're Martians or little green men or Atlanteans. I'm just saying that there was something here 25,000 years ago that was very advanced. And that's all we're trying to establish. We're not trying to put a name to it. I think that Atlantis kind of has a mythos about it, you know.
Yes.
It's like if you don't understand it, ascribe it to God and the angels, you know. I mean, that's sort of the way our society works. But I don't think that's the answer. I think we have to keep digging and looking and finding out if this is a logical system, who built it and to what purpose.
Well, I kind of like the idea that I had a little while ago, and that is again, I don't have words to describe what I felt in the sarcophagus in the chamber. There aren't words. However, it seems to me that if the totality of the experience is produced by the sonic properties in there, that should be able to be precisely plotted and duplicated. It should be able to be done. And if that would be true, you would then have the opportunity to test and see if you could produce an altered state similar to the one that you get in there. And that would seem to me to be a very, very worthwhile endeavor experiment.
Well, that's our cause. That's our purpose for the next year. Art, that's exactly what we're setting out to do with Jim Hertog and Tom and Tom DeBecky. We're setting out to try and do exactly that.
Now, if you don't get the same results, then you've got to begin to imagine there are properties with respect to the pyramid that obviously go beyond the sonic properties. But it would be a wonderful way of narrowing down at least a little bit what we're trying to figure out here.
Sure. Well, don't forget, Art, that the pyramid is very precisely placed. It's probably the most precisely located structure on the face of the Earth. And that perhaps had something to do with it, the directions and the magnetic poles. And if you talk to Dick Hoagland, the location of the pyramid is central to the Earth and to the landmass, and God knows, and corresponds to locations on Mars. I mean, there are all sorts of possible coincidences, and I use the word coincidences in a different way, but I mean, there are a lot of factors here which may have been part of an initial design to create an extraordinary structure that we haven't even scratched the surface yet.
Tom, how carefully have you documented what sonic properties there are in the Great Pyramid, and specifically from within the sarcophagus?
Well, excuse me, I did a series of measurements that seemed appropriate at the time. I did the sarcophagus by itself, and then the king's chamber, and I also measured the air shafts in the queen's chamber, and the tape recordings that we made, those we brought home and analyzed further using a very sophisticated package called Hyperception. And so the information that we got, I think, is quite good.
Would it be sufficient enough to duplicate the sounds in the lab?
I think so. One of the questions that...
All right, hold that thought, okay. Tom. And I think everybody out there knows what I'm driving at, don't you? Can you imagine a computer or a CD that could take you exactly where you go when you go to the pyramid? Now, that would be quite a product, wouldn't it? He thinks commercially. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
The Talk Station, AM 1500 KSTP. Taking your calls on the Wildcard Line at area code 702-727-1295. That's 702-727-1295. This is Coast to Coast AM from the Kingdom of Nye with Art Bell.
Yes, and I want to tell you that if you've got a computer, a PC, an IBM clone, well, you better get ready to pull $99 out of your pocket. I had a Snappy about a year ago, and we sold it at that point for some distributor, and I thought it was an amazing product. I mean, it would take a VCR, camcorder, or TV signal, and you can actually, it's so neat, the software. They've got a little preview window, and you can see what's playing in the recorder, or your camcorder, or TV signal, or whatever. And the minute you see a picture that you want, you just would go click, and it would put a picture on your PC, a still photograph. Well, they sent me the new Snappy and the new Snappy software about a week ago, and I have never in my life seen anything like it. The new software, version 3.0, and the new chip, the Play chip, they produce stills that, if anything, come out with more resolution than the original. Now, I don't know how that is possible. This chip does it in a proprietary manner, but it works. Now, you don't have to open up your computer to add Snappy, because your Snappy plugs right into the parallel port, same place where you plug in your printer. And then you just hook up the video output of a recorder or a TV or a camcorder or whatever, and you're in business. You can do it for you can use it for newsletters, putting stuff on websites, as I do, school reports, business proposals, you name it. As a matter of fact, the new Snappy software even allows you to attach them and send them in email. This thing is beyond belief. It is available nationwide at any computer store. So what I'm telling you is, if you've got a PC of any sort and you don't have Snappy, believe me, you don't have a whole PC. So go to your favorite local computer store and say, I want Snappy, and that'll be that. Price, $99. Snappy. All right, back now to my guests, Tom Danley and Boris Said. Gentlemen, welcome back. I've got something I want to read you here, which I think is dead accurate. Art, here we go again. If you want some proof that Egyptians, as we know of them, did not build the Great Pyramid, look at Cairo. You know, I remember standing on Giza looking at the pyramids and the Sphinx and turning around the other direction and looking at Cairo, and the man has a point.
Yeah, well, you know, and we're building shopping malls, too. You know, John West once said that our civilization would be remembered for striped toothpaste and shopping malls. I mean, our civilization is in decline, and I think that Cairo is as fitting an example as New York City, for that matter. You know, I mean, it's popular to go Egyptian bashing, but I think that the ancient Egyptians, whoever they were, built some of the most extraordinary monuments on earth.
Oh, yes.
And we have now evolved with an artificial society into the point where you don't have to do stuff like this. Instead of creating vibrations to lift a stone, you fire up a diesel crane, you know, and pollute the atmosphere. I mean, that's the problem. We're going downhill, and it's not just the Egyptians that are declining.
Well, again, I think part of science is confirmation, repeatability, and many times it is the elimination of things. And if we were to sonically duplicate precisely in a room, which I believe we could do, Tom Danley would be the guy, and we got the same altered state, we could then begin to conclude that that set of vibrations and harmonics present is indeed what produces the entirety of the experience there. And then, Tom, you'd be a multimillionaire because you could produce something that would produce that altered state in people. So I'm giving you a great commercial idea. Or it wouldn't work at all, and we would then be able to eliminate the sonic component, at least as the sole reason you feel what you feel up there.
Well, I think at least to the first order, in the region of your voice, you probably could duplicate the acoustic effects in there, possibly even on a computer sound card.
Yes.
The a DSP system, you probably could do a pretty accurate job of producing the effect. Producing the sound that's present, that would take a specialized loudspeaker system in order to go down that low, but those exist too. I mean, that's what we use to test with. As far as making $1 million, I like the idea of that too.
You know, you can hear a little of it, Art. I mean, if you listen to the soundtrack on that tape I sent you, at the very end, over the credits rolling, we went down. We used the sound that Tom actually made from the highest down to the lowest.
Right.
At the end.
Right.
And I think people that have gotten that tape will have heard it. It just gives you some small hint as to what happens when you're actually there.
There's also the sound of the F-sharp flute.
Yes.
Which was very interesting. I just think it is a it would be a remarkable experiment to do. Now, I understand it would take probably lab conditions. It would take the right kind of reflectors and very specific speaker systems producing low frequency amplification and all the rest of it, but it sure would be worth a try.
Well, yeah, I certainly am going to...
Art, we're having a series of meetings this weekend with a gentleman who I hope is going to join us in just exactly this sort of an experiment, and he knows a lot about sound and making sound, and it's one of the things I'm going to be talking to Tom about literally over this weekend, but this is something we're about to do as a punchline to our next documentary. So we might have an answer for this in the next couple of months.
All right. Very good. Tom, you were not involved in any of the Dubecki radar stuff, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
All right.
I did go down in the well with Boris a few times, so I know where he's talking about.
Now, that is a scary trip.
Yes.
I'm sure after you've done it several times, it gets to be not quite as scary, but the first time you go down, that is scary stuff, my opinion.
Well, I respect you for going down there. I'm glad that... but I'm glad... Aren't you glad you went?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Yes. But at the time, you have quivering second thoughts, believe me.
Yeah.
Well, a representative of one of the major networks got down as far as the second level, and he fled. And as a matter of fact, we took him down there on Halloween, which was really funny, a couple of years ago.
Oh, great.
And he got as far as that first sarcophagus there at the second level, and that was as far as he was going.
I'm out of here, guys, huh?
By the way, you know, you were talking about the Snappy. I'd like to add a word of praise here. My webmaster, Matthew Sapero, got one today, and he is, as we speak, taking images off my videotape and putting them on my website, which is, I guess, linked to yours, magicaleye.com. But he's raving about it. He called me up today and he said it's the most extraordinary thing he's ever used.
Oh, it is.
So there's a lot of those images are actually going to be on the website during the course of tonight.
Okay, good. Yes, I believe we have a link up to you. If we don't, we'll restore it. But
okay.
I'm sure it's still there.
It's magicaleye.com in any event.
Yep. All right, Tom, is there anything else you want to get out? We're going to continue with Boris, and I know you've got kind of a cold. And I know it's late where you are as well. So is there anything else that you want to tell everybody you're going to do when you go back?
Well, the things that I'd like to do going back would be mostly improving certain aspects of the measurements. There were a couple things I thought of after we got back that would have made sense to do, but I didn't think of beforehand. So there's that kind of stuff. Basically, I would just repeat a couple of the measurements and take more excuse me, time with the digital tape recording the ambient sound And I all I can really say was that it was a fascinating trip, and I can't help but be very impressed with the pyramids and the people that built them. It's absolutely remarkable.
If people built them. All
well,
right.
Yeah.
All right, Tom, my friend, then at this point, then I think I'm going to thank you, and I'm going to continue with Boris, and I'm going to look forward to hearing from you when you come back after this next trip.
Okay.
Tom, thank you.
Good night, all. Thanks.
All right, that's Tom Danley from near Chicago, where it's a little bit later, and he's getting ready to go to bed, I suppose.
Yeah, he's a very brilliant guy.
Just about everybody I know right now is down with a cold of some sort, Boris. It's
not me.
Really?
No, not me.
Good. Good. Then maybe you can carry me, because mine lingers.
Well.
Anyway.
I'll try.
All right. You've got a lot going on. Now, the last time you were on the program, we talked a lot about the secret chamber that we believe to be below the Sphinx.
Right.
Now, the one thing I did lift off your tape, which is on my website right now, is the diagram. I guess it's a picture of the pyramid and the Sphinx,
yeah,
and a sort of a diagram that shows where you think this secret chamber is. Now, this was predicted by Edgar Cayce to be there, and I think Edgar Cayce said it would be opened in 98 or 99. I'm not sure.
That's right.
And you want to open it, don't you?
Yeah, I'd like to open it. I am not 100% convinced that the chamber we want to open is the one in the diagram. There may be a chamber beneath it, down a level, but we won't be able to find out till we get into the chamber in the diagram. In other words, the radar only bounces off one level at a time.
Uh-huh.
So if there's a deeper chamber, it may be deeper. Yes, I'd like to get in there, absolutely, simply because that's what seems to be motivating everybody.
All right. Well, there's nobody in Egypt who is going to let you drill or tunnel down below the Sphinx. They're just not going to let you do it.
I agree.
So you now have shown what you believe to be a tunnel going from this chamber back toward the pyramid.
And back towards the Sphinx.
Yeah. Now, how sure are you that that is there?
Well, I'm this sure, Art. The radar and the seismic tests indicate a 30 by 40 foot chamber about 30 feet below the paws.
Right.
They indicate that they may be filled with rubble or some substance. They're not sure what's going on inside there. DeBecky said it would appear to be half full of rubble. We also did radar tests across the back of the Sphinx in that 20-foot space between the rump and the cliff.
Right.
And at that point, there is indications of a 2.5-meter-wide tunnel down about 15 feet. Now, immediately to the west of the rump of the Sphinx is the cliff, and you go up about 40 or 50 feet, and then the land begins to rise up towards the plateau.
That's right.
So the radar, which is accurate to about 50 feet, is useless the minute you get it up to the top of the cliff.
Mm.
However, there is a straight line coming out from under the Sphinx, which we've clearly documented, which establishes the direction in that 20 feet of excavated floor there behind the rump of the Sphinx, if you follow me. And that goes directly in the direction of the Chephren Pyramid, which coincidentally is exactly where the causeway goes. Now, 300 yards west of the rump of the Sphinx, directly under the causeway, is where that well chamber is that you went into and that we've got,
yes,
all the pictures of.
Yes.
And at the bottom of that well chamber, the DeBecky's radar shows 2.5 meters down under this, what we consider to be a fake sarcophagus lid, this polished black granite slab. Under that is a cavity, which is 2.5 meters wide, has a domed ceiling, and according to Dr. DeBecky, heads off in the direction of the Sphinx precisely, descending at an angle of about 25 degrees.
So you think that is the beginning of the tunnel that would take you down to the chamber below the Sphinx?
Well, I'm not going to say it's the beginning. I'm saying that there's a tunnel there. I have a feeling that the tunnels, that the Rosicrucians were probably right, that the pyramids, the three pyramids, were linked to the Sphinx, and that there was probably some sort of temple-like structure to which all these tunnels came together and then went off in one grand tunnel to the Sphinx. And that temple-like structure may even be a part of what we are beginning to see at the bottom of that well chamber, because there are clearly some right angles down there and crumbled pillars and so forth.
Hmm.
So what I'm saying is I think that there was an underground access, yes.
Do you think that ultimately, this is a speculative question, of course, but that when we get to this chamber below the Sphinx, or even one below that, that we will discover the reason for the pyramids?
Well, it's certainly possible. I wouldn't bet against it. I mean, Edgar Cayce was a pretty clever guy, and he's been pretty accurate. So if he says the records are there, who am I to dispute it? What I think is that Tom and I are going to are going to find the answer possibly before we're allowed to excavate. But in any event, we are certainly bent on getting into that chamber.
Now, how do you imagine you might find the answer before you can go there?
Okay, I think that if Tom's logic is valid and the pyramid is some sort of a giant resonance chamber, and if this winter we're able to establish some sort of a relationship between the Pyramid of Giza and the pyramids at Teotihuacan and Palenque.
Yes.
And if we're able to show that these structures did in fact have a sonic logic about them, then I think even the flintiest heart is going to have to say, hey, wait a minute, these guys are onto something, and there's some scientific reason now to look further. And then I think some of the mathematical similarities of the pyramids are going to come into play, and the geometric similarities, and I think we're going to begin to realize that they were all part of some sort of a giant grid system. That's what I think is going to happen.
Can you explain to me how there would be pyramids all over the world, not just at Giza? They are the most obvious, the most above ground, the biggest. But there are pyramids all over the world, South America, Peru, Japan,
England,
everywhere there you find pyramids. Now, at that time, whether it was when they believed the pyramids conservatively were built or when you believe they were built, there was no worldwide communication of any sort.
That we knew of.
That we knew of, right. So, how could pyramids be all over the place?
Well, there is what they call the 100th monkey theory. I mean, it is conceivable that all of our inspiration came from the same source. That's what most religions are teaching.
Oh, okay. Oh, well, that wouldn't be really the 100th monkey.
Well, no. But what I'm saying is there are lots of different potential explanations. But what I want to know is how come the Native Americans had the same knowledge of resonance, apparently, that the Egyptians did, and managed to produce it with a piece of carved wood, where the Egyptians were producing it with 2.5 million blocks of stone. I want to know how come there is that correlation. See, that can't be a coincidence. And that's what I think we have to study. And bear in mind, as I keep saying, I'm a humble filmmaker. I make documentaries. I'm trying to get guys like Tom Danley and DeBecky and Bob Schock and some of these men of letters, some of these brilliant scientists, to work on these problems.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have an answer. But I think I'm pointing out a relationship that demands some sort of study.
All right, you're going back to Egypt, and last time you were on, we had the long discussion about the involvement with Shore and all the rest of it going over there.
Right.
You're kind of on your own now.
Well, yes. Here's what I'm hoping to do. As you know, and you've certainly been very helpful, and I hope later I can sneak in an 800 number, we've been selling these tell-all tapes, which are basically a compilation of what I've done in Egypt and where we are today. And we are hoping that enough people are going to buy these tapes to allow us to go back to Egypt and persuade the Egyptian government to open this tunnel themselves. not the Shore Foundation or Florida State University or Boston College or anyone like that, but the Egyptian Antiquities Department, University of Cairo, whatever. We're going to try and persuade them to open this tunnel because so many thousands of people want to know, and hopefully we'll have permission to do a co-production on a film over there, which will bring this news to the world. It's 2.5 meters of already disturbed earth that we've got to penetrate to see if this tunnel exists. And I'm hoping we're going to get permission. I'm hoping to go there in December and speak with the new minister of the new secretary of the Antiquities Council and the Minister of Culture to get this permission.
All right. We talked about this a little bit earlier. Now, the fellow who runs Giza is Dr. Hawass.
Dr. Zahi Hawass, right. He's the director of the Giza Plateau and Saqqara.
And so what you're talking about is going over there and going over his head.
Well, in a sense. I think Zahi's been Dr. Hawass has been very helpful to me, and he's taken it as far as he can go.
All right. On that note, hold tight, and we'll be right back.
Holy river, more deadly than the vainest night.
Saeed going over Zahi's head.
Last Saturday evening came to the old oak tree. It stands beside the river where you were to meet.
Gotta wonder what a headless Boris Saeed would look like. We'll be right back.
On the ground, your glove I found with a note addressed to me. It read, "Dear love, I've done you wrong."
What is the single...
To fax Art Bell in the Kingdom of Nine, dial area code 702-727-8499. That's area code 702-727-8499. Please limit faxes to one or two pages. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is. And if you want to talk about music that will produce an altered state, this, I guarantee, is some of it. It's the new Cusco album of Purimac 3, Nature, Spirit, and Pride. And by popular demand, and I mean popular demand, Higher Octave extended the special through November 15th. You know, there's just been a great outcry out there for a Purimac 3. It's understandable. It is $15.98 for a CD or $9.98 for a cassette. The number to call right now, and the first 10 people who call tonight, only 10 now, get an autographed CD by Michael Holm, Cusco's Michael Holm. The number is 1-800-562-8283. 1-800-562-8283. That is part one. Part two gets you a Purimac 1, 2, and 3 for $39.95, and that's what I recommend you do. And you get an autographed poster of the Buffalo Spirit Warrior featured on the cover of a Purimac 3. So, those are two deals. One gets you a Purimac 3. The other gets you all three in the Purimac series. And the offer is coming to a close. I'm telling you, don't wait. This is remarkable, remarkable music. Call 1-800-562-8283. 1-800-562-8283. All right, in the first hour and a half or so, we had Tom Danley here, a sonic engineer, at one time consultant to NASA, who did the sonic recording work in the Great Pyramid at Giza in Egypt. And we talked to him about the sonic properties there. Very, very complicated and unusual. Now we've got Boris Saeed, and we're talking about what Edgar Cayce said would happen in 1998 or 9 A chamber would be found below the left paw of the Sphinx. Well, guess what? Dr. Dubecki, in concert with Boris Said, went over and took ground-penetrating radar and found the chamber. Oh, there's no question about it. It's there. We don't know what's in it, but it's there. And now, they also believe there is a tunnel which will enable us to get there. Now, if you can picture this, now, you don't actually have to picture it. Go up to my website right now, and in the new items, just go on and click over, and you'll see the pyramid with the chamber beneath the Sphinx. You'll see the Sphinx and the pyramid, and the chamber beneath. And this tunnel that Boris Said and others feel is there, going to a point in what's known as the causeway, or below the causeway, where you can go down into a deep, dark, dank well, at the bottom of which you will find a fake, underline the word fake, sarcophagus. Nothing was buried there. The Egyptians apparently used a sarcophagus cover to scare people away. And, frankly, it still works to some degree. But beneath that, Boris Said feels that he will find an intersection to the tunnel that will take him to this incredible chamber below the Sphinx, where many feel the Hall of Records, what is called the Hall of Records, will be found. So back now to Boris Said, and as we came to the top of the hour, he was telling us he's going to go over and talk to the Minister of Culture, who really is the boss of Dr. Zahi Hawass, who runs generally Giza with, I think it's fairly said, an iron hand. Is that fair to say?
Well, he certainly seems to be the director of the plateau. And I'd like to say, Art, just to correct a misconception, he's never been anything but friendly and helpful to me. He's let me film everything I've ever wanted to film.
Right.
And the problem is this. In 1995, when we were, I thought, on the verge of getting into this, getting underground, I signed on with Dr. Shore. And the application for permission to dig and so forth then became the province of Dr. Shore and Florida State University, because Dr. Hawass had suggested that we needed an academic institution to join with us.
He said that again and again, by the way, when
I was there. That's right. What I propose to do now that's different, and which is why I think we're going to succeed, is I propose to go over there independently financed and suggest to them that they open their own tunnel, and suggest to them that they open it with Egyptologists who are Egyptian, with archaeologists who are Egyptian, trained at the University of Cairo, under the auspices of the Antiquities Department, under the auspices of the Minister of Culture, and we would simply be the recording entity that would bring this news to the world in concert with the Egyptians. That's all I'm suggesting. I'm not suggesting that because Zahi has said no, I'm going to go over his head. Zahi has never said no to me. Zahi just said at a certain point, now you have to go to the committee. I have never, personally, Boris, have never applied for permission to the committee. It has always been an application that's been made by, in the one case, in the original case, John West and Boston University, Boston College, and in the second instance, by Dr. Shore and Florida State University.
Well, I asked Zahi, by the way, for the record, when I was there, about John Anthony West, and his comment to me was, by law, he is not allowed on the plateau.
Well, he did it to himself. He certainly is the guy that got me to Egypt, and he certainly is the guy whose theory it was that led to the discovery of the room. I'll give him that credit.
Well, give us a little bit of history. Why is there this great rift between John Anthony West and Dr. Zahi Hawass?
Well, John is a maker of great rifts. That's what he does best in the world. John and I originally met when we were teenagers, and there's a great rift between Boris and John now that John created. John loves to have a war with people. John, when I went to Egypt with him originally, he told me that I was going to meet this mortal enemy, Zahi Hawass, who is dedicated to our destruction. That's how it started with Zahi. it was Zahi and...
Why did Mr. West feel that Zahi was dedicated to his destruction?
Well, here's the thing. John is a very well-educated guy, and I think a brilliant guy, but he does not have the kind of doctorates that it takes to impress the Egyptian academic society.
I see.
So John was always angry because all he had was a B.A. from Lehigh, and he was forced to use guys like Robert Schock, who's brilliant, and Boston College and so forth and so on. I think John, there was always a resentment on the part of John that he was being put down by people for his lack of academic tenure.
Mm.
So he was angry to begin with, and he's angry, in fact, most of the time. That's part of his charm, and he alienated everybody. I mean, you know, it's the same way as Robert Bovall, who's also over there, and I don't know how. I wasn't present. I don't know what was said.
All right. As a matter of interest, you might tell me what I'm in for. This May 10th through the 17th, I received several calls over the last 2 weeks from Dr. Zahi Awas, and he said, "You're the only one I trust, Art, to moderate this. We're going to have this trip to Alaska, and we're going to have on this trip myself, Dr. Hawass, and he's going to bring the number one Egyptian belly dancer," he says. And he said that. And Danyon Brinkley, who would be more or less neutral, I think, but also Graham Henn and Robert Bovall.
I've been invited, too.
Have you?
Yes, I have.
You, I guess you ought to come along.
I don't know whether I should or not. I may see you off. These are important. Count heads when you come back.
Yeah, I know. I'm a little concerned about that myself. My job is going to be that of moderating between all these guys, and they may all finally get angry and decide that I'm the one who should be beheaded. I'm a little concerned about it, but it's going to be very, very interesting. I'm really looking forward to this, sort of.
Well, I'm going to go if I'm given permission to film. I'm a documentary filmmaker, and I am not a firebrand, and I am not going to take sides, and I'm not going to get into a war with those guys, no matter what they say.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just not going to do that. I want to get the story out.
All right. You've told us a little about why antagonism between Anthony and Zahi.
Yeah.
What about Graham Hancock and Robert Bovall? Why the problem there? As I've said on the air before, there was a time, it is said, that Zahi suggested that when Graham and Robert show up at Giza again, should they desire to do so, he would have them beheaded, thrown in a pit, and would defecate upon the...
I'd love to know the source of that story. I really would. I can't believe that Zahi said it, but maybe he did.
Well,
I don't know.
I'm not so sure. I saw both sides of Dr. Hawass, and I can imagine that a bad moment. So.
I got no comment. I can tell you this. I have not been privy to any of the goings-on between Hancock and Bovall and Zahi, except that I do know that Hancock and Bovall and John West have been pushing for... an opening of all the secrets of Egypt, and they have been suggesting that it is not up to the Egyptians to legislate this, that it belongs to the world. And they sell a lot of books. And I think what's happened is that they have just gotten into some sort of a personality conflict with the guy who's the head of the plateau, which is a dumb thing to do. Because I've never had this sort of a problem. I'm as commercial as they are, and I can tell you, Art, and you know him, you've been over there. He has not denied me access to anything. If you'd wanted to go up in those chambers above the King's Chamber,
I know.
You could have gone.
I know. I looked at a little hole and I said, no way.
Exactly.
But I had one day, one miserable day, and not enough time, but he signed permission. He said, you can go anywhere you want to go. I've got to say this, though, Boris.
Yeah.
Other than the tip you gave me about the well and the causeway and all the rest,
yes,
I could have walked around there for days and not gone to a place that was not readily apparent, if you follow me.
Yes.
So when Dr. Hawa says you have blanket permission to go anywhere you want, if you don't know where to go, let's assume that for a second,
right,
that Dr. Hawass has made discoveries that he has not told you, nor me, nor the world about.
Right.
And
right.
I, by the way, I do assume that.
I'm sure.
We wouldn't find them if he didn't want us to.
I'm sure.
Isn't that a fair comment?
Absolutely. And that's why he's the director of the plateau. And, I mean,
yeah,
he's responsible for the plateau. He's responsible to his government. And I think we have to honor that and work with them, you know, and not try and bring the weight of world press down to bear against him and try and bulldoze him and blackmail him and bully him into doing things that he's not prepared to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I've been so desperate to stay in the middle of this thing and not on one side or another, because I think you have to acknowledge that it's Egypt, and I think you have to acknowledge that there are a lot of very sensitive social and political and economical problems over there.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to be aware of those things, and you got to respect those things, and then they let you go where you want.
So, the diplomatic Boris Said will go to the director there.
I'm going to go an Egyptian attorney friend of mine who claims to know all the parties involved, including Tahi, is going to arrange a series of interviews for me, at which I am going to present a case for the opening of the tunnel at the bottom of the well and the exploration of that tunnel. Now, if I'm successful, then I'm going to return with a film crew when the Egyptians say they're ready to start digging.
Right.
And as I've said publicly, I'm going to bring a group of 20 witnesses with me. We're going to pick some names out of the hat of people that wind up buying our tape, and as a sort of a reward to them, and we're going to take a group of people over as part of our crew, and to dispel once and for all this notion of secrecy and, you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls and keeping this from mankind, we're going to film this.
All right. Let's do a couple of what-ifs. Let's say the tunnel is there.
Yes.
All right? But let's say that you begin moving down that tunnel, and at some point you're blocked.
Yes, or it's underwater.
Whatever. You can't go any further.
Right.
Then what?
Then I'm going to go to them, and I'm going to say, okay, guys, look, here's a diagram. And if you take this tunnel and you move down it for 75 feet and you come to a blockage, and this dotted line represents the presumed extension of the tunnel, since it's been straight all the way. It's silly to presume that it suddenly turns to the right or to the left. And gosh, look, it comes out right at the tail of the Sphinx, and it's only 15 or 18 feet down. Can we please drill with a high-speed bit? Can we please, under your supervision, carefully, slowly drill at least down into the tunnel where it goes under the tail of the Sphinx? At that point, the same thing would be true. We put down our spy camera, our 2-inch diameter camera, and if the passage is still blocked, then, of course, then there's the third what-if. Look, our radar showed it's there. Is there some way that we can persuade you to drill a hole at an angle under the front paws of the Sphinx? Nobody's yet asked them if we could tunnel in at, let's say, a 40-degree angle from 200 feet away, which was presumably then not disturb the paws at all. I mean, there are lots of possibilities if we can prove to them something which they don't believe at the moment. If we can prove to them that our radar has in fact discovered a tunnel, it doesn't matter whether if the tunnel leads to the Sphinx chamber, hallelujah, we've succeeded. If not, at least we've proved that the radar study is valid. And then we can go back to trying to persuade them to open a hole directly to the room. That's what I hope is going to happen.
Do you think that Zahi Hawass and those above him really would allow the world to see simultaneously what is in there? Or do they want first crack at it? Now, if you were an Egyptian and you were Zahi Hawass, what would your answer be?
Well, if I were an Egyptian and I was Zahi Hawass, I would have started looking for that room in 1991 when America's foremost seismographer, Dr. Thomas DeBakey, proved that the room was there.
Mm-hmm.
And
but he didn't.
Well, we don't know that he has or he hasn't.
Oh, yes, that's a very good point.
And there may be nothing there. I mean, look, this is what the radar says. All we're asking is the chance to dig and have a look. Do I think that they're going to keep it to themselves? Honestly, no. I think that they're going to be so proud of it. I think there's certainly a question that they'll allow us to open it on worldwide video. I think they may want to see what's in there first. But I think that they've been very proud about everything they've ever excavated. And Zahi firmly believes that if there's anything in that tunnel, he thinks it's an 18th dynasty tomb. He told me so.
You know, they are presently trying to divert tourists from Giza. They've made some new discoveries of tombs in the last couple of weeks, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. And I saw some stories indicating that the crush of tourists at Giza is so heavy right now. They're trying to come up with antiquities to draw tourists away from Giza.
That's right. That's right. And that's certainly going to be one of the problems. But do I believe they're going to sit on a discovery of this magnitude? Absolutely not. And the main reason for it is that they're starting to feel a surge of tourist pressure from what we should now seriously call the New Age, which is one of the most enormous buying groups in the country.
Oh, yes.
And far outspends and outnumbers the people who know the difference between the 16th and the 15th dynasties. People are going over there now because of the astounding feelings that they're getting over there because of exactly what happened to you in the pyramid.
All right, that's right. All right, you tried one time before and failed to be able to explore this. You were unable to go any further.
Yes.
Has it occurred to you, Boris, that the prediction of Edgar Cayce may be the reason you failed? In other words, I know I'm getting a little out there right now, but it just simply wasn't yet the right time.
Well, that's certainly possible. I certainly believe that that's possible, probable in fact. But that doesn't mean that you quit trying. I mean, I think if you sort of sit on your hands and you wait till 1998 and say, okay, this is the time, now we start. I think that if we are allowed to go in there in 1998, it's because we spent all of 1997 hammering on the door.
Mm-hmm. But maybe that was all meant to be that way.
Maybe.
1998 is not very far away.
Maybe. But, I mean, what I'm looking at is this. I've heard, for example, when my original film, this one that is now in dispute that we can't show, the Dr. Shore film, when that was shown to some Egyptian officials, they criticized it as being, quote, a publicity for the Shore Foundation, unquote. That's why I want to go back to them and suggest a film which would be publicity for Egypt, quote, unquote. And I really believe that under the right circumstances, they will allow us to film the opening of that tunnel.
All right. Boris Said, stand by. He's our guest. We will get to the phone shortly. And I'm going to tell you about Boris Said's tape when I come back from the break. This is a tape you're going to definitely want to get your hands on. Believe me, I've seen it, and it is absolutely top-notch. This is Coast to Coast AM.
With Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM from outside the U.S., first dial your access numbers to the USA, then dial 1-800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM from the Kingdom of Nye with Art Bell.
It is, and we are back. Boris Said is my guest. We're talking about the pyramids, the Sphinx, and the great mystery. And I'll tell you, what's coming up in May is something you shouldn't miss. You barely still have time. Let me quickly tell you about this and get it out of the way. I have been invited to what may be Mission Impossible. I don't know, but it sure as hell is going to be interesting. There is a cruise coming up May 10th through the 17th. It's going to Alaska. It is going to some of the most northern sacred sites that you have ever laid eyes on. It's almost beyond description. The ice flows, the inside passage. The north is very nearly indescribable. It's an amazing, amazing cruise to take. Now, I've already taken it. So there wasn't a chance I would accept this. I mean, it's going to Juneau, Skagway, Ketchikan, then back to Vancouver. You'll see it all. You will see all the wonderful things that I got to see, the glacier-carved fjords, all the rest of it. It's just, it's beyond description. It's got to be one of the world's wonders, no question about it. But what got me to go was, my part of the invitation is for the last 3 days of the cruise, the Inside Passage, coming back from Alaska to Vancouver. And during that period of time, on board will be Dr. Zahi Awas, Danion Brinkley, Graham Hancock, Robert Bavall, Dr. Ed Krupp, maybe Boris Said, who has been invited, I just found out, and I'll be there too, trying to moderate all of this. It will be a great debate over one of the greatest mysteries in the world by the people who are probably most deeply involved in these mysteries. I'm going to be there, and I am inviting you to be there. It's about sold out, so I'm telling you right now. Matter of fact, you can try calling right now, the numbers I'm going to give you. The financial end of this is incredible. I mean, absolutely incredible. Really, really a good deal. And so it's kind of like a once-in-a-lifetime deal, and I couldn't turn it down. The nationwide number to call, all except for California. California has a separate number. Californians are so different. The rest of the country, though, can call 1-800-888-5509. That's 1-800-888-5509. And I, you know, if you can't get through now, try between 9 in the morning and 6 at night. This can be one of the last times you're going to hear me do this. Talk about this, because it's about booked up. Don't wait. I'm telling you. If you're in California, you call area code 310-568-0138. Let me give you the California number again. 310-568-0138. Or again, for the rest of the whole country, 1-800-888-5509. And I look forward to that with some muscles that tense involuntarily. It's really going to be something. Really going to be something. All right, we'll get back to Boris in a moment.
Just smart.
All right. Boris Said, the last time he was on the air with me, talked about a tape that he was in the middle of producing. Boris is, of course, now no longer associated in any way with the Shore Expedition, University of Florida, and the Shore Expedition. And so what he is doing, what Boris wants to do, is go back to Egypt and open the secret chamber below the Sphinx by accessing the tunnel he believes is there. They've already done all the radar work to determine that this chamber that Edgar Cayce said would be there is in fact there, and there may even be more. Now, the idea of producing the videotape was to finance the trip back to Egypt, and many, many of you, based on faith, ordered that tape, I don't know, it was a couple of weeks ago, I guess, before it was even done. The tape is now complete and ready to ship. And Boris Said sent me a copy of this videotape, and I must tell you, it is a class AAA production. I mean, it really, really is a good videotape, and it will give you a very precise idea of the importance of man to mankind, of what he is proposing to do. Fortunately, now, tonight, he's going to be able to offer that videotape to you for immediate shipment, I think. Boris, is that correct?
Absolutely, and I'd like to say that the first 300 have already gone out. They went out at the end of last week, so people should be getting them along about now.
Okay.
But we now have a fulfillment house, which is sending these things out because the demand has been enormous.
Well, now that you've actually got it for shipment, I think people are much more likely to call and order. What is the number?
Okay, the number is 800-1-800-243-1400.
800-243-1438.
Okay.
That's 800-243-1438.
You want to tell them about the tape?
Yes, and for those of you who are outside of the United States or in the Seattle area, because it's coming out of Seattle, Washington, the number to call is 425-455-1053.
Wait a minute. 425...
455-1053. And the 800 number again is 800-243-1438.
All right, well, tell us about the tape.
Okay, and by the way, you can buy that with a credit card or any which way you like. Incidentally, it's $25, and we're calling that a donation. We're pledging that all the money for the tape is going to go towards this work that we're doing. It's $25 plus $3 shipping and handling. And an added plus is that we're going to select 20 names among the people who have bought the tape, and we're going to take them to Egypt with us. 18 people are going to go for about 50% off for the same rate that the film crew goes, and two people are going to go free. Two people are going to get their tickets and hotel rooms, and that's going to be done by lot.
Okay.
So that's the commercial. The tape itself is a compilation of what I've done. It's a 40-minute tape thereabouts that... It introduces you to the secret chamber under the paws of the Sphinx with a 7-minute excerpt from The Mystery of the Sphinx. It introduces you to Tom Danley's work. It shows his levitation work, and it shows Tom DeBecky.
Charlton Heston is in it.
That's right. Charlton Heston narrates it, and it shows Tom. It's a film. It's a film which won an Emmy in 1993. And it documents the work of the John West expedition, for which DeBecky found the secret chamber. I mean, it actually shows the radar work, the seismic work being done, and shows the chamber, shows a diagram of the chamber. It features an interview with my friend Zahi Hawaz, who promises to open the tunnel one day under the Sphinx. There's some good shots of Zahi, and it includes a promotional tape that we made in 1995, which outlined the work that we proposed to do on the Sphinx, and there's some very beautiful footage there by Garrett Griffin. And then at that point, of course, we ran afoul of the Shore Foundation, and so from then on, there is a series of photographs, like a photographic montage of some of the work that Danley did, because a lot of that footage is in dispute at the moment legally.
Right.
And it culminates with some high-8 footage that was shot by an Egyptian cameraman friend of mine who went down into the well that you were in, Art.
Mm.
That shows the sarcophagus lid, and it shows the well and shows that entire chamber. And it tells a little bit of the story of what happened with the Shore Foundation and with 20th Century Fox and Mr. Murdoch, and why we never finally came to the end of the road with them and didn't resolve itself into a film.
It at one point showed Zahi Hawass down near that or in the entrance headed down saying Indiana Jones would not even dream to be here.
That's right.
And it does suggest that he is prepared under the right circumstances to open it.
I'm convinced that he is. I don't think he's ever been unwilling to. I just think the problem has been that certainly my efforts have always been hampered or certainly controlled. I don't want to use the word hampered, but they've been controlled by the expedition that's been funding the film.
Right.
In the first instance, John West and his group, and in the second instance, Dr. Shore and his group. What I'm hoping is that if we get enough response, and there are, God knows, 15 million people out there, if enough people get involved with us, I'm going to be able to go over there in December with thousands of letters of support from people, and they're flooding my website, and go to them and say, look, you know, the people of America want to know, and this is your story, this is your country, this is your tunnel, please open it, and we'll film it, and we'll make the production out of Egypt, and it'll be an Egyptian production as well. And in that way, they can't say they're being exploited, and in that way, they'll have total control of what happens. And in that way, I believe that they'll be very expansive about telling us about it. I mean, that's just my opinion. Now, I may be wrong. If I'm wrong, I hope you guys are entertained with your 40-minute tape, and I'm sorry about the trip to Egypt, but I believe it's going
to
work.
Well, all right. I would like to ask you your opinion now. This is just your opinion. When we get into that chamber, what do you think we're going to find?
Well, I think that we're going to find a lot of rubble. I think, and that's from DeBecky's findings, not mine, I think we're going to find hieroglyphs, which will be probably very ambiguous and will be subject to a lot of interpretation. I think that if we get in there and there's enough space in there to work and we set up the radar and the seismic stuff again, we're going to find levels below that chamber.
Mm-hmm.
A very great psychic, Zev Coleman, an Israeli psychic, has suggested that he has seen steps leading down and a jade pillar and all that sort of wonderful stuff. I think we're going to find levels below it.
Yeah. What I'm getting at here is, do you think it's possible that we will find the Hall of Records?
Yes, I think it's possible. I think that the Hall of Records, if you think, I know you've had Michio Kaku as a guest, his string theory of physics described the universe in a one-inch theory. So the Hall of Records could be one tablet saying, this is the answer.
It could be. Now, my question is, if the answer is not a foretelling of the coming of Christ, something that validates Christianity or Buddhism,
mm-hmm,
or any other, perhaps Islam, whatever, if it validates none of the religions and suggests to us that our ancestors, those who came before us, were not of this world. And that's entirely possible, Boris.
Absolutely.
It would upset everything that we know and everything that we are, and there are people who would kill to prevent that information from becoming public.
Well, that's absolutely true, Art, but you look at it a different way. If we don't pretty quickly upset everything that we are and everything that we're doing, we're going to kill ourselves. I mean, we're headed in the wrong direction, ecologically, sociologically, economically. We're headed for disaster. I mean, I'm not an alarmist, but I think it's about time that somebody breathed some fresh air into this thing and said, hey, you guys, you took a wrong turn someplace. You should turn left back there at that church.
Yeah.
And I for one, I believe that this race that we're engaged in now to find this ancient wisdom while we still can. I did an interview with a Zulu high priest who suggested that the Zulus believe men have 12 senses, and that until we're fully conversant with 7 of them, we're not going to survive as a species. Now, it's very interesting when you think how just in our lifetime, the sixth sense, the psychic awareness, has become an everyday thing virtually. And you talk to Michio Kaku, who lives on 10 planes. I mean, to him, it's a reality.
I know.
So I don't think it's going to be so terrible to upset some of our paradigms. I mean, what if we upset the paradigm of war or bigotry or hatred? I mean, God forbid. We could even wind up with a peaceful world.
Going back to something a little more solid for a second about the pyramids, here's a fax. Maybe you can answer it. There are only a handful of cranes and crews in the world right now that are able to lift 200-ton blocks,
right,
and that is their maximum lifting capacity. And to effect a move of such blocks to the site of the pyramid in question requires 3 separate setups, each taking months to create. Now, when you finally get these stones on the site, what the hell do you do then?
Right. How do you place them? How do you remove whatever it is you lifted them with? How do you get whatever it is out from underneath the stone?
All right, these are the reasons, or at least some of the reasons, Boris, that I suspect there is a Hall of Records, and there is an answer that we may not be so comfortable with getting when we get in there.
I agree.
And so what you are proposing is extremely exciting, extremely interesting, and you're probably right. We need to know. But I'm not sure what effect it'll have on the world.
Well, let me take your supposition a step further, Art. I mean, as long as we're going to get out there, let's get out there. It's the hour for that. If the answer is that some sort of an external civilization from another planet,
yes,
came and made all this,
yes,
okay, maybe instead of getting down on our knees and praying to them with our hands clasped, or instead of facing Mecca or whatever one does and whatever religion one prays, maybe it's 99.5 megacycles or something, and we can just send them a simple help in a language which is, we discover down there, and they come and move the rocks for us.
Well, you remember they talked about in 2001 the monolith. As a matter of fact, is something that Professor Kaku talks about quite a bit.
Perfect example.
Maybe the monolith, or the equivalent of the monolith, is not on the moon, or Mars, or one of a Jupiter's moons, but is instead right here on Earth.
Yep. On the Giza Plateau? Or
on the Giza Plateau.
Absolutely. Why not? Why not? I think it's absolutely possible. Once we accept the fact that it's possible that there's stuff we don't know. I mean, we live in this terror that we're going to discover something new. You know, you've got to knock down the paradigm before you can begin to let the light in. The world is flat. The world is flat. I mean, I'm just reading a story about Magellan now, and I mean, when Magellan set off, the three-quarters of the thinking world thought the world was flat.
Mm-hmm.
And when ships were lost at sea, they'd sailed off the edge.
Yeah.
And that's not so long ago as mankind goes. That's like 400 or 500 years ago.
I couldn't agree with you more, but I really, really, really wonder, Boris, about what would happen to all of our religious and scientific institutions. There would be a period, no doubt, of extreme chaos if such information were revealed. Boris, hold on. We're at the top of another hour, and you can relax for a while. Boris Said is my guest, and when we come back, we will go to the phones. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Mishki for Buck Hill.
Taking your calls in the Kingdom of Nye from east of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, including Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico, at 1-800-618-8255. First-time callers may reach Art at area code 702-727-1222. That's 702-727-1222. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. Now here again is Art.
Here again I am. And in a moment, I think I've got something for Boris to chew over. Really chew over. I certainly would, and I think you would too, after you hear what I'm about to read. I'm going to read some of what Edgar Cayce said about the opening of the Hall of Records. Back now to Boris Said. Boris?
Sure.
You know, even if you can't film, I really think you ought to come along to Alaska. You'd be good to have there because, you know, if real hell broke out, I could turn to you and I'd say, well, Boris, who do you agree with, Dr. Hawass or Graham Hancock?
That's one great reason for not going. All right, look, here's the thing, and this talks right, I believe, to the heart of the matter and to what I want to do as a film documentarian. Okay, we're all sitting there on the boat.
Yeah.
Laval says, look, I've got this computer study that says that in 10,500 BC, these air shafts in the King's Chamber lined up with the planets of Orion,
right,
which is where the Egyptian mythology says the home of the gods in the afterlife was going to be.
Which is what he is going to say, yes.
Okay, terrific. And Graham Hancock will somehow link it all to Quetzalcoatl and the pyramids of Mexico,
okay,
or whatever.
All right.
And then they will both say that there's a chamber under the back of the Sphinx, and it's mirrored in the heavens and so forth and so on. And that's fabulous. I love the books. I've got both books sitting in front of me.
Right.
I read their stuff, okay?
Yep.
And Zahiawaz is going to say, that's a lot of nonsense. We've dug up, you know, signs of a bakery and a brewery, and we know how these pyramids were built, and the whole thing was done by Egyptians. And
we've got, as a matter of fact, he's got further proof in the burial ground of those who built it. You know I was there.
Right. 20,000 workers. Let's say that conservatively that's 15,000 loaves of bread a day.
Yeah, but you know, even Zahi will admit, workers or not, he doesn't have a clue how the stones were actually moved. He showed how they could be split.
Okay. My problem is this, with all of this, that when there is an explanation other than slaves and rolling logs and what have you, it comes from a source like, and I respect the sources, Jim Hertog, Greg Braden, people who are terribly educated, and they have these amazing theories. And the problem is that I can't understand them. I don't understand about talking about seven powers of nine pyramidal grids and all of that sort of stuff. I got trouble enough talking to Tom, and he explained it to me carefully. I think that the extraordinary thing is that if these people were this bright and this knowledge was so pervasive and all over the world, which is what we're beginning to see, and which is what the Aborigines have been talking about and the Hopi and the Bushmen, then I think that approaching it from standpoint of color or music or standing stone, something that everybody can understand, then it's going to have meaning. That's what I want to do. That's what I'm looking for, is a link that people can understand.
All right. I'm going to give you something to think about, and I want an answer to this. The following is from Edgar Cayce's Supplement number 57, Prehistory Egypt, July 1st, 1932, reading, A15 excerpt. With the storehouse, or record house, where the records are still to be uncovered, there is a chamber or passage from the right forepaw to this entrance of the record chamber or record tomb. This may not be entered without an understanding, for those that were left as guards may not be passed until after a period of their regeneration in the mount or the fifth foot race begins. Now, I don't fully understand that, but what I do get from that is that there are certain things, well, I've seen maybe too many movies about this kind of thing, but I can sort of picture Boris Said making his way along this tunnel and giant shards coming down and running him through, or blocks coming down on his head and crushing him like a cartoon character. In other words, if you believe what Cayce said, then there are certain things that will get you.
Well, there are certain things that are going to get you anyway. Yeah.
Well, that's one way of looking at it.
I mean, look, I'm going to make my film, okay? And the chances of anybody allowing me to be the first person down the tunnel are slim to none. There's going to be a zealot, an Egyptologist, an archaeologist, somebody going down that tunnel.
It's going to be Zahi, you know it is.
Well, I hope so.
So it would certainly be very dramatic seeing a gigantic stone come down on Zahi, squishing him into a cartoon character.
Well, I think, obviously, if we're going to go exploring a subterranean tunnel, we're going to have to be very, very careful, one. Two, I think there's every chance in the world that it's flooded, which may present a different set of problems.
And not insurmountable.
That's right, not insurmountable at all, because at the time nobody envisioned scuba gear and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
The other thing is that I believe that if we can prove that there is a tunnel, then I think that with the advanced kind of drilling equipment that exists, we may get permission to drill right into the chamber. Don't forget that what Zahi used as an objection to me was that in 1978, I believe it was 78, Stanford University came and drilled three or four holes. They were drilled to a depth of 3 meters and turned up nothing.
Right.
They were very noisy drills. They were high vibration drills. They were 20 years old. There is now very sophisticated equipment.
Boris, what do you think that Casey meant by this may not be entered without an understanding?
Well, I'll tell you, my interpretation is that you probably had to understand some sort of a complicated system of entry that may have been numerical, it may have been vibrational. There is probably a great complexity to getting in there. I don't think it's just a tunnel in the ground. I think if these people were as advanced as they're supposed to be, they would have done something more complicated than a dog could do.
When he said, for those that were left as guards may not, and it's underlined, may not be passed until after a period of their regeneration in the mount or the fifth foot race begins. Now, I don't fully understand that, but the clear implication here is that there are things that would stop you from entering until the time was correct.
Right. Or, I mean, if we take the mount to be the pyramid, then perhaps what Danley's talking about is valid. There are all sorts of places on the plateau that I've taken Tom, one of which I think I told you a little about, where those four pillars are behind the Kenkos tomb.
Yes.
Where there's no vibration at all. It's like a Faraday cage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that place has great significance, and nobody's studied it yet. So what do I think it means? I don't know. I don't see huge, giant boulders and stakes and, you know, poison gases and stuff. I don't see anything sinister in it. I think it's just that it's going to be difficult to figure it out. And I think that in order to figure it out, we're going to have to find our clues in places like the Great Pyramid. That I believe.
All right. Let us begin to take some calls. I'd like to open the lines. And since you know so much about the pyramids, the Sphinx, and you'd be a good one qualified to answer listeners' questions. First time caller line, you're on the air with Boris Said. Hello.
Hi, Art. This is David from Phoenix.
Yes, David.
I just wanted to let the listeners know that besides the video, there's this interesting article in the October-November 96 issue of Nexus. It's a magazine out of Australia.
Right.
It talks about the pyramid, and among other things, it talks about Casey's prediction that this would be discovered and opened between 1996 and 1998.
Right.
And it talks about the Atlantean Hall of Records. And he also thought that the pyramid or the Sphinx was actually built around 10,500 BC. And the article mentions that the pattern of erosion on the Sphinx indicates that many researchers think that it was built around 12,000 years ago.
All right. Well, what the rocks seem to show, and this is one of the things that is clearly, very clearly shown in Boris's videotape, and I would like to talk to you about it, Boris, is it shows the erosion of the rock and suggests that erosion by sand would have left a pitted surface, and that the erosion that in fact is present there could only have been produced, and they show it in great detail, by water. Is that correct? Where'd you go, Boris? Oh, we lost Boris. We lost the connection somehow. That does occasionally occur. Was I asking some sort of a question that I should not have been asking? I don't know. I'm going to take a moment break, and we're going to get hold of Boris again so that he can answer that question. Because on his tape, beyond any shadow of a doubt, I think there is visual evidence, specific visual evidence, that it was water erosion. Now, you're talking about a desert, or at least what today is a desert. So we'll get Boris back on the line and have him answer that. Are you having arthritis?
Pain.
All right. Well, I don't know how it happens with a system that locks calls in the way mine does, but it happens. and we lost connection, but I've got Boris back. And Boris, what I was saying is that in your videotape, it seems clear beyond any shadow of a doubt that the erosion on the rock is not been caused by sand and wind and pitting, but that it is smooth, and this erosion could only have been produced by water.
I agree. I mean, that's Robert Schock's thesis, and I think he's, I mean, it's self-evident.
It is self-evident. I mean, the tape, your videotape, I think, is incredibly clear on that point. Now, if we accept that as fact, what does that mean?
Well, it means that the Sphinx was damaged by a downflow of water, not a rising of the river, which would have eroded the bottom of the cliff first, but a downpouring, water coming off the plateau. And when we consulted Professor John Kutzbach out at University of Wisconsin, who's an expert in the study of ancient weather patterns, he says they have lots of data and fossils and God knows what else to prove that there were lakes in North Africa and on the Giza Plateau 9, 10, 12,000 years ago.
But the kind of erosion they show there would have had to have occurred over a very long period of time. It wouldn't have been one instant flood that would have worn rocks away that way. It would have been a very extensive period of rain or water.
A couple of thousand years of rainy weather could have presumably done it.
Absolutely. Now, there has not been that in the period of time that conventional wisdom says the Sphinx was constructed in the pyramids.
Nor were there any people around capable of constructing the Sphinx. That's the other thing. See, I mean, if you can't have it both ways. If the Sphinx was carved in 2550 BC, then how come, as we said in our video, according to the rate at which the Sphinx eroded, it could have eroded, it would have been completely gone by now. If you follow the conventional reasoning, and when some of the Egyptologists who have said that the Sphinx was carved from such a poor quality of limestone that they had to patch it as they were carving it. Dr. Schock, to that, as I recall in our video, said, how come they built temples with these rocks? And
yep,
the temples are still standing here.
Exactly right. All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Boris Saeed. Good morning.
Greetings.
Greetings. Where are you?
Cincinnati.
All right. Cincinnati.
I want to say this first, Boris. If the whole system were rehabbed and set up as it once was, then I think the idea of guards and vibrations would come into play, and I'll tell you what I mean, okay? I came out of a meditative state, and I was in the sarcophagus, and it became clear to me that there were three things going on. One was soul travel while the body was safely lying there. The second was meetings with teachers who are not in bodies. And the third was a testing system that was rather severe. So the idea of guards, I think, has to do with the protection of the knowledge and the admission of people who are at the right frequency, I would say.
Okay.
All right. Well, that is kind of the New Age take on things there. And I don't rule it out, Boris, because of what I felt when I was there.
Yeah, I think definitely that it has to do with vibrations and awareness and everything else, I'm sure. But I don't know how we can quantify that.
I know it sounds to the audience who has never experienced it kind of touchy-feely, but believe me, folks, once you've been there, you know something serious is going on, really serious is going on.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, people have had out-of-body experiences for real in those pyramids, and they're documented. I had one. A lot of people I know have had them. And there are things that happen to you in Egypt physically which are unavoidable. I don't care how skeptical you are. So I wouldn't rule that out at all. And I think that the lady's quite right that it has to do with possibly changing the vibrations of our own body-mind complex to the point where we become aware of some of these directions, instructions, passages, or whatever.
Boris, could it be true that what Casey meant and what is true is what that lady said, that those who would go down to that chamber and go through that tunnel, the ones who would make it would be the ones who had reached a larger understanding imparted within the pyramid, within the king's chamber, within perhaps even the sarcophagus.
Very possible. Very possible. Why not? Of course. I would believe that. I mean, it's anything that's complicated to do, you have to learn how to do. I mean, I used to drive a bobsled. You don't learn to do that in 20 minutes, you know. You have to build yourself up to a certain awareness of a certain series of tests and things that you have to be able to overcome that not everybody can do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's a huge big sign that says, "Enter here, welcome to Atlantis." I think it's complicated to find the answer to this.
Well, I agree with that. Let's see if we can get one in quickly. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Boris Said. Wait a minute. Now I press the button. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Boris Said. Hello.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening. Where are you?
This is Dave from Vancouver.
Hi, Dave.
Hi. Art, were you aware that there is an album? It's available as a 2-CD compilation, and it's called Inside the Great Pyramid. It's recorded in the Pyramid of Giza and in other structures on the plateau there.
No, I wasn't aware.
Yeah, excuse me?
No, I was not aware. I said it's very interesting, but I don't know that it produces all of the resonances that have been recently discovered. And that's, of course, what we've been talking about.
Probably not. I have not been there myself yet, but when I put it on, the vibrations of it, I don't know, makes your top of your head tingle.
is that the Paul Horn album?
Yes, it's Paul Horn.
That's
all right.
Fabulous.
All right. Hold on. We will return in a moment. If you have questions for Boris Said, come now. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
You're hearing Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. International callers may reach Art in the Kingdom of Nye by first dialing their access number to the USA. Then 1-800-893-0903. 1-800-893-0903. And you may fax Art by calling area code 702-727-8499. That's area code 702-727-8499. Please limit faxes to one or two pages. Now again, here is Art Bell.
We are discussing one of the great mysteries of the world. As a matter of fact, in North Africa, actually, Egypt, the Sphinx, the pyramids, and what may lie beneath. When it comes to information on ETs, if you're like me, you can't get enough, and I'm telling you, you've got to see this spine-chilling video, Area 51, the alien interview. Thousands of you already have. A few of you, or I guess many actually, have seen just a little tiny bit of it on Extra or maybe Strange Universe. But here, you've got the entire ball of wax, a 65-minute documentary containing the most convincing color footage of government agents interviewing what certainly appears to be a space alien inside the infamous base at Area 51, smuggled out by a guy named Victor, who spent a couple of very frightening hours with me on the air. He's now actually in fear of his life for his part in spiriting this footage out. Now, of course, some would say it's not real. But you can judge for yourself without much pain. The tape is $19.95 plus shipping and handling. You watch it over and over. You let me know what you think. 2 weeks for delivery. And the number to call right now is 1-800-510-3420. That's 1-800-510-3420. Back now to Boris Said. Boris?
Yes, sir.
All right. A lot of people want to talk to you, so we need to lay heavily into the phones.
Okay.
But you do have a videotape, which not only is incredible, but is going to finance your way and maybe others back to Egypt to do all that you want done.
I hope so.
And the tape now is finished. It is a class AAA product. I guarantee that to my listeners. How do they get it?
They get it by calling 1-800-243-1438. That's 1-800-243-1438. Or if they're in Seattle, in the Seattle area, 425-455-1053. And that holds for anyone outside the United States and Canada. They have to call 425-455-1053. The tape's available for a $25 donation and $3 shipping and handling. They can accept fax orders and all of that. But that's the easiest way to do it. Give them a credit card or give them your address and they'll send it out to you right away.
All right.
Incidentally, Art, if I can mention just once again, we're going to run a drawing. We're going to draw 20 names out of a hat. And if we go over there to open this tunnel in the spring, which I hope we're going to be able to do, we're going to take 20 people with us. 18 are going to go at crew rate, which will be about 50% off on hotels and airplane fares. And two people will go absolutely free.
Free. That's cool.
So that will be those will be 20 people who will be an official members of our team. We're going to give them windbreakers and t-shirts, and they're going to be witness to this.
Well, at least they will have seen the tape, so they'll know what they're doing.
That's right, and when they come back here, they I hope, will be living proof that there are no secrets over there. And I don't believe there are going to be. I know that you may disagree with me, a lot of people disagree with me, but I think the Egyptian government, when they're given a proper way of presenting this news, they're going to be thrilled and proud to do that.
All right. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Boris Said. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Art. Good morning, Boris.
Where are you, sir?
I'm Dan, and I'm in Virginia.
Okay.
Art, you're reading the part making reference to the mound, I think, in Edgar Casey's
yes, sir.
Prediction.
Yes.
And I think what that might refer to is what is known as the Temple of the Mount.
It might.
And which was the Temple of Solomon and the Dome of the Rock, and that's known as the Foundation Stone of the world. And I think, I believe that the Ark of the Covenant supposedly was there, you know, several hundred years ago. And I think that ties in with the pyramid in Egypt.
Yeah, you could be right. I mean, or it could be the pyramid itself. It's really hard to say. But I'll say this, Boris. I would... I think that I would be frightened. Is frightened the right word? I'd be really, really, really cautious and wary of making my way down toward that secret chamber. Really wary.
Well, cautious is a better word than frightened.
Yeah.
You know that Sir Francis Chichester, the great round-the-world sailor, once said that the only thing worse than fear was being prevented from doing something that one really wanted to do by fear. And I think that caution is the answer here. But I think that given the opportunity, I can't imagine anybody saying, I'm not going down there.
I don't know if I would agree with that. I'd have to think about that a little bit. First time caller line, you're on the air with Boris Said. Hello.
Hello, Art and Boris.
Hi there.
This is Eric from Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Hi there.
And hi. I was actually had a comment and a question about what you guys were talking about earlier on whether when you go down into the Hall of Records or the room down there, if that does contain documents that are going to have a major impact on the world's religions, something stating that you know, we're from somewhere else other than Earth, don't you think that might lead to some kind of information suppression, or you know, that the world wouldn't really hear about that kind of
thing? My answer is yes. I think it would. I think it would be suppressed before you could say Zahi Awas.
Yeah, but the other thing is,
I know Boris doesn't feel that way.
It's harder to suppress information these days. You can take a camera down there the size of the palm of your hand and bring back broadcast quality photographs and video. It's very difficult now. I mean, there's such an information network around the world that it's hard for me to imagine them being able to suppress this sort of thing.
Well, Let me put it to you this way, Boris. There is one possibility, and that is that before you arrive, before any cameras arrive, in fact, it may already have happened, that you recall in your video, there stood Zahi Hawass saying, "We will open this," and he stood right in front of it.
That's right.
Now,
certainly possible.
How many nights does Zahi Hawass go to sleep without thinking, you know, I've got a real good crew of guys here. Why don't I go down and open this thing and see what's there? See if I can make my way down to this this secret chamber below the Sphinx before camera crews and Boris arrive.
Absolutely possible. No question about it.
Well, if something is found that profound, what makes you think it would still be there when you followed behind with cameras?
Well, because I think that the nature of the Giza Plateau is that everybody seems to know what's going on there. And, you know, for every guy giving an order, there are nine guys digging with Galabeas. And those nine guys have got families and cousins, and the word seems to get out. And I just believe that if they get in there, that the word will get out at least that they got in there. Now, you may be right. They may suppress it. They may sit on the whole thing, and we're not going to get in there. That's absolutely, or we may get in there, and it may be empty, which is why Tom Danley and I are doing what we're doing, because we believe that there may be several ways to find this information.
Dr. Dubecki's radar study of the chamber below the Sphinx, you said that it showed rubble.
That's what he said. He said,
yeah,
it looked...
Well, my question was the radar really definitive enough to be an absolute surety that it was rubble?
No. Dubecki said that his interpretation was that the chamber, he said there was definitely a different consistency of the rock, leading him to believe that it had been excavated, and he felt that perhaps the ceilings had collapsed or stuff like that. He felt that he was getting the kind of reading he sometimes got from an incomplete landfill. That was his original statement in 1991. Now, there is no clear way of knowing, short of drilling a hole down there, to find out what's really there. There is no valid reason not to drill that hole, given the...
So then the statement about rubble is at least in part conjecture.
Yes, it is in part conjecture, absolutely.
Now, the fact that there is a chamber there is not conjecture.
Not according to Tom Dubecki.
All right.
He believes it's there. He believes his instruments prove it. And again, you know, that the government position is that they drilled holes in 1978. But I asked Zahi a straight question in Virginia Beach when he was speaking. And I said, how deep were the holes? And he said, 3 meters.
Right, that's correct, yes.
And that's not deep enough.
Well, right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Boris Said. Hello.
Hello, this is Karen in Houston. How are you, Art?
Fine.
All right. I've got a question for you gentlemen and a little bit of a statement intermingled in here.
Sure.
Okay, you answered part of it just now when you said that Dr. Hawass was there in Virginia Beach. What kind of credit does he give Edgar Cayce for his comments and insight into the pyramids and the Sphinx? I mean, if he's a believer, more or less, then he would understand, you know, that in the earlier Cayce writings also, he said that the pyramid was a place of initiation.
Yes. I really think my answer is I don't think Zahi has a lot of respect for that, but I can't speak for Boris. Boris?
Well, he certainly didn't mention the word Edgar Cayce down there in his talk that I heard. He was talking about stuff they found, findings, and all of that sort of thing. But he has always steadfastly denied any evidence of a chamber under those paws. He has been firm on that. He doesn't believe the radar, and he doesn't believe the seismic stuff.
Right, but if you take it step by step, the way Cayce unfolds that area and the use of the area, and he's very specific, and also since Edgar Cayce was also very avidly, every year of his life, he read the Bible through, you know, completely from top to bottom every year for his life. I mean, he also tied in with scripture where, like, Moses was trained in the mysteries of Egypt. And many times it mentions in scripture, you know, over and over, where Joseph and Mary fled to Egypt. And there is quite a tie-in there between what we are getting in scripture and what Edgar Cayce has said about that area. And if the information is under the Sphinx, as he says, given Casey's background also in the Masonic order, I don't know, but I think this ties in maybe with a peacemaker. Those who would have such information would have to have the right, what was the word that you used a while ago?
Understanding.
That's it.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
I would believe that. I think that's a valid point. I wouldn't dispute that.
Do you think that Zahi Hawass unreasonably ignores anything that is in the slightest unscientific and leans toward the metaphysical? Do you think he's got a bias against that, a natural bias as a scientist?
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. I don't know if I would categorize it as a bias. I think that he just thinks that, I mean, when we originally started our project in 95, it was called Legends of the Sphinx. And he spent hours telling me some wonderful legends, everything from King Solomon to lions leaping out from under the Sphinx to guard the dead.
I mean, legends, yes. But when it really gets down to it,
The man is a scientist. The man believes in what he finds. He believes in archaeology.
What he can lay his hands on.
Exactly right. Yes.
All right.
He does not embrace anything otherworldly or other dimension.
Metaphysical.
Nothing metaphysical, right.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, that doesn't make him any different from Mark Lehner or any of the other scientists I've met since I've been working on this project. They're all pretty steadfast. I mean, even Robert Schock was a little bit, we used to call it the A word. If anybody mentioned Atlantis, Schock used to get up and leave the room.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Bora Said. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, my name is Grace, and I'm 14. My mom wanted me to call.
Okay, Grace, you're going to have to really get into the phone and yell at us. Where are you?
I'm in Rancho Cucamonga, California.
Okay.
And I'm 14, and my mom wanted me to call.
Okay.
Because for a long time, I've always thought there to be a library under the Sphinx.
Right.
And I always thought there was a stairway leading down to the library. And it wasn't built underground, but it was built on top of the ground. And at the time it was built, it was on top of the ground. But it was covered by sand because of strong winds and, you know, as time passed. And I was wondering if this was, like, scientifically
okay,
possible.
Well, they've done... we'll answer your question. I would presume that Dr. Dubecki has done a great deal of ground-penetrating radar work in a circle surrounding the area where he's found this chamber, looking for something like this young lady just talked about.
Right. There's nothing that I have ever seen in any of his work. Zev Coleman, the great Israeli bioenergist and psychic, suggested that there were steps leading down to a chamber and then steps leading down to yet another chamber.
Right.
And I think in some of the stuff that Jim Hertog, Dr. Hertog has uncovered, alludes to different levels beneath the Sphinx and inverted pyramids and in water and all sorts of wonderful stuff. We did find in our scientific investigations that the land fell away in front of the Sphinx, and that there was some evidence for the fact that the Sphinx was sitting on what would amount to have been a cliff, and then as it was gradually all silted in or sanded in as from the flow of the Nile. But I don't know anything about a staircase going down. I wouldn't dispute it. There may have been. I mean, I think all that terrain was different when the Sphinx was built.
Mm. All right. East of the Rockies, you are on the air with Bora Said. Good morning.
Hello, this is Walter in West Chicago.
Good morning.
West Chicago. Hi, Walter.
Yeah, you want the secret to the pyramids?
Yes.
Yes, we do.
The secret is the seven cords of the ancient scriptures. You know what a cord is?
Yes.
A chord is a tone. I
know you can do a chord on a piano.
Yeah, right. I was told that's the secret to the pyramids, the seven chords of the ancient scriptures, and that would be the answer to your problem.
Well, that would be off into the category of the acoustic expert, and I wouldn't be able to answer that. You know anything about that, Boris?
Not a thing. I'd love to know what those chords are. I would love to see a diagramming the chords. That we could send to Tom Danley and say, here, Tom, run this through your computer.
Well, it may be you'll get down to some point about halfway down that tunnel toward the secret chamber, and there'll be something that won't open until the right chords are played.
How do we find out what these seven chords are?
I don't know. That's a good question. First time caller line, you're on the air with Boris Saeed. Good morning.
Good morning, Art.
Hi, where are you?
My name is Rod. I'm in Mississippi.
Yes, sir.
And pyramids have always been a fascinating subject with me. The nature of them themselves is kind of interesting, and I've actually done some scientific experiments with pyramids. In particular, I've scaled my models according to those of the Great Pyramids, such as you're discussing, and there's a correlation between them. The height is always 0.54 times the base, and it forms an angle of 47.36 degrees
right.
with the base. Now, that by itself is nothing, but the experiments that I performed is I calculated the volume, which would be the base squared times one-third one-third times the base squared and times the height, and formed a cube, which actually it comes out to be the cube is about 0.56 on each side times the base. But anyway, I made a cube and a pyramid of the same volume. Align the pyramid north, south, east, and west, and I put an orange, I cut an orange in half, put half the orange in the pyramid, half the orange in the cube, and I invite all the listeners to reproduce this experiment at home. Just make a scale model of the pyramids of Giza.
Yes.
And put an orange, put a glass of milk, and I put some bean sprouts in a moistened paper towel inside the pyramid, one inside the cube, also a dull razor blade. After 3 weeks, the razor blade was sharp. The bean sprouts had grown about three times as fast as the ones in the cube. The milk was not sour. It was, in fact, yogurt. And the orange, although dry on the outside, was still juicy on the inside.
And the cube?
The cube, oh, it was nasty. It was pretty disgusting.
All right. I have heard this. That was well described. Now, I've heard this same story from many, many people about pyramids anywhere, which may, by the way, account for why we have found pyramids all over the world.
Right.
Now, an orange is an organic thing. A human being is an organic thing. And it kind of makes you wonder, do you think there is anything to this business about the power of the pyramidal shape?
Do I? Yes.
You do?
Yes. Without question. But whether the shape, whether it's just the shape or the shape in concert with the vibrations is another story. I think it has to do, I think it's the whole thing taken together, and I personally think, I mean, we're on the way to proving the stuff about the sonics. It's going to be interesting to me to see the comparison between what happens inside Palenque, inside Teotihuacan, and inside the Great Pyramid, because the shapes are so different. It will be interesting to see if there's a correlation there.
Well, if there is indeed something to the metaphysical power, and I only use that word for lack of a better one, of the pyramid, then that may go to explain why we find pyramids that shape, in fact, all over the world.
Right. I agree. Okay. I wouldn't doubt it for a minute. I don't think there's anything metaphysical about it. I think it's just an aspect of physics, as Michio Kaku would say, that we haven't come to understand yet.
And so we ascribe it to magic, that which
That's
we
right.
don't understand, of course. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Boris Saeed. Hello.
Hello, good morning. This is John in St. Louis, Missouri.
Hi, John.
I did some reading, and this is, again, very, very interesting topic, and you were talking about maybe having the pyramid of the tunnel open prematurely. In one of Casey's writings or books that I've read is saying that behind the door in the Hall of Records, there's a sentry, and there are a type of guard that has been set up.
Exactly.
That is only high-minded people that are attuned with the planet or that are in tune with our...
Those with understanding.
And it, yes, yes. And I think that it's going to take, even though they go in or they do find it, it's going to be rather interesting on who's going to be able to go in and maybe, you know, get to this Hall of Records because they know that, I guess, they will go.
Well, let me ask you this, caller, just for fun, okay?
All right.
Let us say the tunnel is ready to be explored. Who would you imagine to have the better chance? The pragmatic scientist, the director of antiquities, Dr. Zahi Awas, or Boris Saeed, who is my guest tonight and would appear to have more of a, quote, understanding the meaning of all this?
I think Boris would probably be someone that will not hide the truth, sort of like the Dead Sea Scrolls that are scattered and they're not letting them out. Something that, you know, he'll actually use it for good.
So you think that Zahi might end up with a stake through his heart?
Well, no, I don't think it'd be that serious, but I think it would be more or less they'll give him the message that, you know, no touch.
No touch.
No touch. It's going to be a certain individual, certain type of person to go in.
All right. And on that note, I'll have to say thank you, and we will do one more hour coming up in some markets. From the high deserts, I'm Mark Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. STB.
For the Twin Cities and beyond, I'm Mark Bell, live on AM 1500 KSTV.
To reach Art Bell in the Kingdom of Nye from east of the Rockies, dial 1-800-825.
1-800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, including Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico, call Art at 1-800-618-8255. That's 1-800-618-8255. First-time callers, dial Art at area code 702-727-1222. 702-727-1222. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. Now again, here's Art.
Here I am, and we have one line marginally available, maybe. The first-time caller line at area code 702-727-1222. Our guest is Boris Said, and he is preparing to go shortly back to Egypt, financed by an incredible videotape that he has produced about Egypt and about why we should be going back there, that is available to you, and we'll tell you how to get it again shortly. Well, it is everywhere. Even Boris's web guy got a snappy, and he's going nuts. Everybody who gets one of these goes nuts when they realize they can take the best video and make stills out of it. It is a remarkable ability. Boris, you're back on the air again.
I'm here.
All right, good. Lots of people want to talk to you.
Good.
So, first-time caller line, you're on the air with Boris Said. Hello.
Hello, Art. This is Josh in Oregon.
Hi, Josh.
Hi, Art. Good to talk to you finally. Hello, Boris.
Hi there, Josh.
Hi. Grateful Deadhead fan here, and tonight I saw a video of Ken Kesey, Mary Prankster, climbing up one of the pyramids in Egypt, placing the Grateful Dead emblem on top of the pyramid. That was interesting. I just wanted to mention that before I go into my question. Do you think Zachariah Sitchin, author of Zachariah Sitchin's point in the book 12th Planet, he mentions the Hebrew word Nephilim. Would you think maybe that's behind the door that you guys are going to enter, or whoever the high people go, or maybe they'll take a Grateful Dead head with them to that opening, perhaps, yeah. Or somebody like that, even.
I don't know. Zach's work is very compelling. I don't know what's behind that door. I'm the film documentarian. I'm trying to keep clear of agendas and out of the line of fire politically here, and I'm going to try and get it open and say, okay, guys, what do you think it is? I'm steadfastly neutral here, but I think that Zach may be right. That may be what's back there.
Yeah, I mean, whatever that is. I said my suggestion would maybe take a couple good musicians with you, or some really open-minded healer-type people who are holders of quartz crystals or even amethyst crystals or many of the minerals that are on this earth. Because, I mean, who knows what's really down there or up there. Maybe that other caller said there's another dimension. You know, that could very well be.
It could be a transportation.
Well, I think that the last question we answered, Art, before the end of the hour, the lady said something about people being at the right vibratory, if people being in tune, in harmony with the earth. If you go back to what Tom Danley was talking about, maybe that's what you did in the pyramid, was you got yourself into the right sort of harmonic relationship to the earth, and then you went in the tunnel. And maybe it's whether Zahi Hawass lies in the box, or I lie in the box, or Art Bell lies in the box, or John Anthony West, we all get the same kind of a buzz, and in we go. It's just that simple.
It could be that simple.
I mean, I like to stay away from this sort of hierarchical approach to I'm more enlightened than you are. You know, I mean, I think you can get a lot of trouble that way.
Well, maybe the tunnel will find out who is and who is not enlightened.
Well, that is certainly a possibility. I can tell you this, that if somebody says we're going to open the tunnel, I'm going.
Enlightened or not?
Yeah, enlightened or not, and you can write on my tombstone, he almost made it. He got closer than most.
I'll bear that in mind, Boris. Wild card line, you're on the air with Boris Said. Hello.
Hello?
Hello.
We're here.
Hello there. Going once. Going twice. Gone. East of the Rockies. You're on the air with Boris Said. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Just fine.
Evening, gentlemen.
Where are you?
I'm in Peoria, Illinois.
All right.
Wow. Tim. I apologize first. I don't know if this has been covered or not. I don't get to listen to the program from start to finish. I'm working.
I understand.
Someone had said that a gentleman had also said that only the right person at the right time could enter this tunnel or this hidden room, the secret room. Do you think that maybe it could be that these were built as like a legend, like that some like Aborigines perform, or people of real deep thought and religion perform, that not of something that is going on when it's built, but of something that they believe will happen? I mean, do you understand what I'm saying?
I'm not sure that I do. You there, Art? Help me.
Well, I'm here, but I'm not sure I understand either. Caller, you want to rephrase it, please?
I'm trying. I'm losing my train of thought here. Not so much that it was built, the pyramids were built and the tunnel was built for a certain purpose at the time that it was built, but for something that was going to happen in the future.
Oh.
Like Art, with your book, The Quickening, you and a lot of your other guests talk about something that is taking place now, something that is going to happen.
Okay, if it was built by others, people mm-hmm. from elsewhere, then what you are suggesting is certainly a possibility.
Right.
Mm-hmm. If, in fact, it was built by people here on Earth, then I cannot imagine such an unbelievable endeavor would be undertaken without immediate reason.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, if they had, everybody talks about their advanced technology then, or technology that we don't understand, that we haven't tapped into. If they had that and they had this knowledge or this technology, then they would know.
Again, it is the great mystery. We don't know whether it's built by people who were just in Egypt 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, or whether it was built 12,000 years ago by people from elsewhere, and so your question bears on which of those is true.
That's right, and it's a speculation. It could be, I mean, anything could be true. I what I'm trying to do, as I say, I repeat, trying to do, is focus my attention on what we can determine, which is what are the possible reasons for this thing, what are the possible effects of its being. It is unquestionably there. It's one of the most extraordinary monuments on the face of the earth, structures on the face of the earth. What does it mean?
Boris, I'll ask you the straight-out question. You still haven't seen Contact?
Am I what?
Have you seen the movie Contact?
Yes, I have.
All right. Oh, great. Do you remember the part where the question was asked of Jodie Foster, is this worth dying for? The opportunity to go on that machine.
Right.
Is the opportunity to go down that tunnel and find out what might be in that chamber worth dying for?
Of course. Of course, because it hasn't been proved to me yet that dying is anything other than another life experience.
Okay.
I mean, I've lived my whole life not so much in, you know, with no regard for the possibility of dying, but I think that death is only a catastrophe in a three-dimensional world. And if we're in a three-dimensional world, then I might just as well be dead, because it can't be a three-dimensional world. Ask Michio.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is absolutely correct. West of the Rockies, you are on the air with the fearless Boris Said.
Yeah, hi, Art. This is Jerry in Anchorage, listening to the mighty KENI.
Anchorage, Alaska. Yes, sir.
I've got two questions. The second question, which is in two parts. Question one, do you remember that chamber, that passageway they found inside the pyramid that's about 8 inches square?
Yes. Yes, Boris can tell you about that. What about it?
Do you think that maybe instead of it being meant to enter by humans, that maybe a cat would go through it?
I don't know. Ancient Egyptians certainly worshipped cats.
Yeah, and my second question is...
But cats are really lousy at opening doors.
My second question is, if this hollow record or whatever is found underneath the Sphinx... then the knowledge contained, if the knowledge contained and found there would be so radical as to change the government systems on the planet of Earth and cause such chaos, what would happen? Could that possibly be what starts the 7 years of tribulation?
The answer would have to be yes, it could be. Boris?
Well, look, we did this thing on dating the Sphinx, okay? And I think we proved pretty conclusively that the Sphinx was a lot older, scientifically. I don't see anybody burning any textbooks. I don't see the academic community accepting this knowledge. I think if we get into this chamber, there's a big sign that says, you know, God is alive and living in Lodi, New Jersey. I don't think the world is going to suddenly go to Lodi and bow down. In other words, I don't think that our society is so malleable that it's going to change directions 180 degrees or even 5 degrees according to something that we find in Egypt. I think it takes a long time to make this ship come about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why, I mean, absolutely, all these things certainly are possible, but I don't believe that we're going to find something which is suddenly going to make everybody in the world turn 180 degrees. And certainly I don't think it's going to have any effect on religion, which is basically an abstract kind of a system of meditation. Isn't it? I mean, it's abstract. I can't imagine you're going to find a tablet down there that says, stop believing in God.
Well, I don't believe that either, Boris, but I do believe that the Hall of Records could reveal a reality that predates our knowledge of God a couple of thousand years ago.
I think that would be fabulous.
As imparted by Jesus, and that would be real trouble. Real trouble.
Yes, it would. But I think that we're in real trouble to begin with. So it's just a question of degree. I think if we can come out of this whole search for knowledge with a better understanding of how to survive, a lot of people may be able to do something else with their bomb shelters.
East of the Rockies, you are on the air with Boris Said. Hello.
Hello, this is Sharon from Georgia.
Hi, Sharon.
Hi, how y'all doing? Well, I've been thinking about this. You know how there was always a curse on the tombs when anybody went in there, they got sick, or a supposed curse, you know?
No, not supposed.
There was a curse.
There was a curse, and there were people who died. Boris will tell you about that in a minute.
Okay, well, maybe that has something to do with the Sphinx, too, because maybe there's something radioactive in there or something, and anybody with knowledge... I'd better take a Geiger counter in there or something, you know?
Well, whatever it is that's in there may not be detectable by a Geiger counter, but Boris, why don't you tell us the story of the opening of the tomb?
Well, this is really more properly an Egyptologist yarn, but there was this man named Carter who opened, who found the tomb of Tutankhamun after years and years and years of searching. And they opened the tomb, and it was filled, as we all know, with riches. It's one of the most extraordinary finds of all time. And six of his closest associates, including his backer, Lord Carnarvon, died of mysterious ailments. I mean, one guy was bitten by some sort of bug, and I mean, these six people died of all sorts of mysterious diseases, and they all died, apparently, like within a year of the opening of the tomb. So there's a lot to be said about the reality of what we're calling a curse. Certainly it's possible. I mean, there are a lot more people believe in curses than don't believe in curses in this world. So I believe that that could be absolutely valid. There could be some sort of a psychic thing that's been put on these tombs and put on all of these places. But I think we have to push on in spite of it and just hope that the answer will be there. I don't think we should be deterred by stuff like that.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Boris Saeed. Good morning.
Good morning.
Where are you, sir?
I'm in Oklahoma City.
Oklahoma City. All right. Speak up good and loud for us and ask your question.
Well, I have two questions, really. One is, you keep talking about vibrations. And I read a book, it's been a good while ago, that there's a some kind of tomb in Egypt there that it can be only lit up by the sun only one certain time of a year when the sun's at a certain angle. And all the rest of the time, you know, it don't never light up the whole tunnel.
Okay, well, that's Indiana Jones stuff, or is there something to that, Boris?
Oh, no, there is something to that. There's the there is a room in the Karnak Temple in which there is a fabulous statue of Sekhmet, and the sun only shines through a crack in the ceiling and illuminates the statue on one day of the year. There's also the famous Holy of Holies at Abu Simbel, which is, of course, a temple that was moved. And there's one day of the year, I believe, the 21st of October, when the sun, when it rose, lit up the very depths of that temple. That's absolutely valid.
And the second question is, you keep talking about a library, supposedly, in that chamber and stuff.
The Hall of Records, yes.
Yes. Have you ever wondered what kind of language it would be in? If it would be in, like, a hieroglyphics, or would it be like a Phoenician cuneiform or something?
Well, it's a very, very good question. If it's hieroglyphics, they're going to be able to decipher it. If it's in something that is indecipherable, then I'm afraid the answer points toward something we may not want to know about. Boris?
Well, I don't know. If you were to ask me to pick a language, I'd pick mathematics. I'd pick numbers.
The most common language of all.
Exactly. I think if you look at what's happening with the crop circles and all of that sort of stuff, there's a geometry involved. And with Richard Hoagland's stuff, the stuff that makes it believable is the geometry and the mathematics. So that would be my bet.
Hoagland, as you know, is very suspicious that whatever we find over there will have been found or investigated or removed by somebody before we can get to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I know Richard well, and that's been his thesis all along. He may be right, but so what? I mean, that doesn't mean... How does that alter our course?
Quite correct. Boris, hold tight. We'll be right back to you. It is the bottom of the hour.
It's been a too long time with no peace of mind, and I'm ready for the times to get better.
This is Crystal.
I've got to tell you, I've been right. My brain, hoping to find a way out. I've had enough of this continual rain. Changes are coming, no doubt. It's been all too long.
Wildcard line at area code 702-727-1295. That's area code 702-727-1295. First-time callers may recharge at area code 702-727-1222. 702-727-1222. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
All of this probably even true of Cleopatra. What do you think? Depends on the day, I'd say. You really can't lose, because you buy it and use it, and if in 90 days it does not do precisely what I say, you get all your money back. Ironclad guarantee. 1-800-406-0469. Once again, here is Boris Said. Boris?
Yes, sir.
You've done very well. We are in the stretch run here.
Okay.
Now, your videotape is absolutely astounding. I've got a copy, so now I can tell the audience that. I watched it stem to stern. They will love it. How do they get it? 1-800-243-1438. And it's $25 plus $3 shipping and handling.
Right. And all the contributions, they are donations, they all go directly and specifically towards our efforts to get back over there this spring and get that tunnel open. I'm going to take 20 people with me as witnesses. They're going to go at 50% of a normal rate, which is our film crew rate with EgyptAir and the local Mowenpick Hotel over there, which is a 5-star hotel. Two people are going to go absolutely free of the 20, but
they're really financing the expedition.
That's right, and 20 of their number are going to come over and be witnesses to what we find. Incidentally, I should say that in addition to that 800 number, if you're in Seattle, which is where I am, or outside the U.S., it's 425-455-1053. 425-455-1053 if you're in Seattle or outside the U.S.
When can they call these numbers?
Anytime. It's a 24-hour service. I think they have an answering service on at night, but it's a 24-hour fulfillment service. You leave your credit card number or whatever, and they send you the tape. And you can either buy it by credit card, or you can order by fax, by mail. You can send them a check or whatever.
Okay. All right. Here we go.
$25 plus $3 shipping and handling.
First-time caller line, you're on the air with Boris Said.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Right now?
Yes. We don't screen calls, so...
Oh, okay.
You're on.
Super. I'm Dan. I'm calling from Vancouver.
Okay, Dan.
What I'm asking is probably something bizarre and probably makes no sense to both of you, but I'm just wondering if maybe the chambers is something from, like, some people don't like to talk about extraterrestrials that probably came here in the past. And maybe there was a chamber where they kind of adapted to our Earth before they felt comfortable enough to wander among us. Like, for example, the different races that we have, they all seem to be from different areas. And I'm just wondering if that chambers maybe were used in that respect. And also, do you think of other pyramids, do they have chambers alike? And would their frequencies or resonance be connected to the main one there?
Well, opinions are like pyramids. They're all over the world. and yours is fine. Mine, I think my opinion varies between two possibilities. One is that, yes, all of that was put there by somebody from, or somebody's from somewhere else. I consider that to be a 50% possibility, along with the possibility that ancients here on Earth put it there so that we might know how to avoid what seems to be a coming event or cataclysm, if you will. Boris?
Why not? I think that's as good a theory as any. Again, I believe that that there were people that lived in other places, or beings that lived in other places. I can't imagine we're alone in the universe. Again, I'm trying really hard as a documentarian to focus on what is demonstrable, what basically we can convey to people and what people can understand. And I think any of these speculations are valid. If you ask me what I believe, yes, I believe that there were beings from other planets, other worlds, if you like, who were here for whatever reason. I think Zach Sitchin's stuff is really very interesting. So is some of Von Daniken's stuff, for that matter. I mean, there's all sorts of valid speculations as to where all this stuff
came
from.
Okay, one thing that I ran into when I was in Egypt that I'm hard-pressed to explain until I thought about it a little bit is the tombs of the workers. Now, I saw them. I was there.
Okay.
I walked among them, and this is where the people who actually built the pyramids are buried. Now, that doesn't mean that they did it alone. That doesn't mean that there was not intervention that allowed them to build what otherwise, even with thousands of workers, would be literally impossible.
Right.
And so when I saw these tombs, I thought, okay, here it is. This is the explanation. People built them. Obviously, people built them. But it does not answer all the questions, not by a long shot. Not even with that many people can you imagine how they were put together. There's simply no acceptable scientific explanation for that. Even Zahi Hawass admits that.
Okay. I agree.
He admits that. He says, yeah, but we don't know how they did it. And so that would indicate to me that maybe they were directed and assisted. Just my little theory.
I wouldn't disagree with that.
Okay. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Boris Said.
Hi, guys. This is Debbie. I'm from Denver.
Hi, Debbie.
And I'm wondering, you know, you were just in Egypt and you were in that sarcophagus?
Yes.
And Greg Braden talks about that those things simulated the zero point that he sees us heading towards with the zero magnetics.
Yep.
And the increased frequency, the base resonant frequencies. Did you feel something maybe akin to something that we're heading towards when you were in there?
I had no great revelation, if that's what you mean. What I felt, I cannot yet put words to, but it was a sort of a what I felt in every fiber of my being, my whole body, there was no question about it, but I experienced no out-of-body stuff. I experienced no revelation or anything like that, but something was definitely going on. I'm sorry, that's insufficient. One day I'll figure out how to say it all.
Well, maybe we all will. And one of the things that I'm wondering about getting into this Hall of Records, when they talk about the right people going in, Greg also talks about being able to maintain a certain frequency level in our bodies based on emotions and that sort of thing.
Right.
And if maybe that was a tuning device, like some of the ancient initiates went through that and they were tuned to things that we were going to be experiencing here and now. and if maybe that is a prerequisite to being able to enter into that Hall of Records.
Well, that certainly, thank you, is exactly what Edgar Cayce has said.
That's what a lot of callers have said tonight. I mean, that seems to be like a consensus of what's going to happen. And, well, I wouldn't disbelieve it. I mean, that's coming from an awful lot of different people.
Well, I guess they feel it too, and so one really has to wonder if Zahi leads the way, how he'll fare. I'll ask him that.
I think Zahi's getting a bad rap here. Zahi may believe, you know, I mean, Zahi, let's face it, Zahi has got a very, very difficult position and a very volatile job. And who knows what he really believes?
Well, I'll tell you what he said. We stood on the side of the Sphinx by that little hole that goes down 3 meters.
Okay.
And I asked Zahi directly, I've got it on tape, I said, Zahi, what do you think is beneath the Sphinx? And he stopped cold and he said, nothing. I think there is nothing down there. He said, but I understand the world's people need a reason to hope. And he said, that's fine. But if you ask me what I think is here, nothing. He said, not one grain of sand, not one artifact has ever been found on the entire plateau to suggest there was Atlantis or anything else ever present.
But that's the party line, Art. That's what present-day academia believes. And if I were the director of the Giza Plateau and working for the Egyptian government, and that's what I would say, too.
Publicly.
Publicly, of course.
Now, do you think that Zahi privately has more of a metaphysical outlook on it? In other words...
Do I personally think that?
In other words, let me finish. An understanding... Does Zahi have an understanding that would allow him to enter if Cayce is correct?
My personal belief? I'm gonna have my head chopped off. Yes, that's what I believe. I believe that Zahi is much more open than people give him credit for being, and I think Zahi is in a terribly difficult position with a lot of pressure on him, and I think he's saying just exactly what the job calls for. And I mean, there's a job ethic involved with being the director of the plateau.
That's true. First,
but if I believe that if I demonstrate to Zahi that something's there, Zahi is going to embrace it. I think he's open to that.
All right. First time caller line. You're on the air with Boris Said. Hello.
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 Hi. My name is Carol. I'm calling from Sacramento.
Yes, Carol.
I am a little nervous because I always have microphone-itis. But I wanted to tell you guys, first of all, I'm kind of amazed that you have not discussed the Roman historian Josephus and what he said about the pyramids being erected by shepherd kings who came out of the east. They were Arabian. According to his own records, anyone in the library goes to see his writings, he says that. And also, in Isaiah 19:19, the Lord says in Isaiah 19:19, quote, I have placed signs and wonders in the middle of Egypt and at the border thereof, even unto this day. Now, the phrase, unto this day, is a code phrase for the last days, okay? And
how do you know that?
I'm studying the Bible and studying things around the Bible.
Well, what passage would indicate that is a code for the last days?
Well, the word is hermeneutics, okay? And it's a long word, but unto this day means the last of the days.
All right, well, if we take then what she said literally, I would say that we're close to that time based on what's going on in the world right now and the way we're headed ecologically. If this is all to be discovered in the last days, then I think that will be pretty soon. That's just my opinion. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Boris Said. Good morning.
Good morning, Eric. I was just wondering, Boris, has anyone ever taken the pyramid... I understand. Yeah, obviously, it's at an angle. Has anyone ever extended the lines out using, obviously, the Earth's round? And what I'm suggesting is that there's the pyramid as this point, and then taking the lines or the angles of the pyramid and taking them all the way out to the Earth and see what geometric pattern or where the points would meet. I don't know. Does that make any sense?
It makes sense. I would think if anybody's ever done anything like that, it would be Richard Hoagland. I don't
exactly.
know of it.
Because even Art, I mean, one illustration that you have on your webpage that you just put out, that symbol that people see, it looks like a tetrahedron.
Yes.
You know, that, you know, when I look at that, if I just put that little point of that, like say the circle is the Earth, and I put that little point, instead of being inside the circle, just a little bit outside the circle. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
I wonder if anyone's ever done that. And I know I don't think the Earth's perfectly round, so you'd probably have to do some calculating with that. I just wonder if anyone ever did that, and I'd be interested to see where those points, what was at the end of that.
Okay, Boris was correct. The person you'd want to ask about that would be Richard Hoagland. He's done a lot of work in that area. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Boris Aid. Where are you, please?
Texas.
Texas, okay.
We're the Hall of Information, or the Hall of this library, what makes y'all think it exists?
Well, nobody knows for sure. Edgar Casey said that there would be a chamber found beneath the left paw of the Sphinx, and sure enough, it has been found. So, you know, that's better than, that's pretty good wild guess, wouldn't you say?
Okay. We know there's a chamber there because the radar and the ground penetrating radar and the seismic stuff shows us a chamber. We don't know what's there.
Well, has there been a practical use for pyramids throughout the century besides tombs? Have they been just used for tombs?
No, they were never used for tombs.
Well, what were they built for?
Ah, that's the $64 million question.
That's right. That's what the whole thing is about here.
Have they been invaded, broken into around the Earth?
Oh, yes.
What's been found in them?
Nothing.
Yeah, see, that's the great myth. The great myth is that pyramids are burial tombs, and that's absolutely incorrect. So if you get anything out of the program tonight, get that. And that should start you wondering, well then, what are they? And that's what this is all about. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Boris Saeed. Hello.
Hi, Art. This is Mike in the KEX country.
Yes, sir.
It seems like years ago I remember hearing Dr. Gene Scott mention that at the bottom of the descending passageway in the Great Pyramid, there was a bottomless pit that they'd never found the bottom to.
Not that I know of.
I was wondering if your guest would have any clues to that.
All right. I don't know anything about a bottomless pit.
The pit is the devil of a long way down there, I'll tell you, as it is, I believe, 176 paces up to the King's Chamber. It's something closer to 300 down to that pit.
Well, yeah, but that's not bottomless.
It's not bottomless.
Deep.
I've been down there. It's a very claustrophobic experience, and it's a long way down, and it seems to be three times as far coming back up, but it's not bottomless.
Yeah, nor is it I guess you could say a devil of a distance.
Yes, but not, I mean, it certainly has a bottom.
All right, Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Boris Saeed. Hello?
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Hello.
Turn your radio off.
Yes, thank you. I just want to say what a delight it is to hear this approach about this subject. This is Alan and Eugene.
Hi there.
And information about perhaps some kind of guards at the doorway or passageway into this. There's a Native American story that seemed to come to mind about that, about White Buffalo Calf Woman.
Yes.
And the two men who spotted her, one was essentially destroyed by his lust, his greed, in meeting her, and the other had a reverent attitude. And he was rewarded with, I guess, the knowledge.
Yes.
So that, to me, that seems like a good analogy for what might happen when this tunnel was explored.
Well, caller, where did you say you were?
Eugene.
Eugene, Oregon. If you had the opportunity to go down the tunnel, do you think you would be qualified to do it? Would you do it fearlessly?
Well, I guess That I think I would. I'll tell you what I think I would hope to be able to do is to do it with a sense of reverence, wonder, and some joy.
All right. Well, very good. I think that's
I would agree with that, and I never said I'd go down there fearlessly. I just said given the opportunity to go, I'd go.
All right. The videotape will explain it all to you, and you can get it by calling 1-800-243-1438. I've got the numbers.
Oh,
1-800-243-1438, or if you're in California, no, I'm sorry, if you're in
Washington,
or maybe out of the country, you can call area code 425-455-1053. Boris, we're out of time.
Well, thanks again, Art.
You bet. Thank you. We'll do it again, and I guess pretty soon, Boris, we'll know.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. I hope you can join us when we go over.
Either that or I will read your eulogy. Good night, Boris.
Good night, Art.
Good night, everybody.